you gain a new understanding into the law, which affects all of us. The new series of The Law Show with me, Dr. Joelle Grogan, starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds next Wednesday afternoon at 3.
It's 6 o'clock on Friday, the 1st of November. Good morning. This is Today with Nick Robinson in London and Justin Webb in Philadelphia.
The headlines this morning: Spanish officials say dozens of people are still missing after the flooding disaster, which is known to have killed at least 158 people. GPs, care homes and hospices are warning that they could be hit hard by the rise in employers' national insurance contributions announced in the budget.
And also in today's programme, no Democratic candidate in modern times has won the White House without winning Pennsylvania. The votes suggest a dead heat. I've been hearing about an election campaign which has frazzled minds and divided families.
Do you ever talk about politics?
No, we don't. Really.
No, we don't. We try not to talk about politics.
My definition of what it is not his definition. So it's his prerogative who he votes for. It's my prerogative who I vote for.
And after the actress Saoirse Ronan silences the Graham Norton sofa with a comment on women's safety, Nick takes up the topic of how women keep themselves safe on the street with perhaps his toughest interviewee yet, his daughter Alice.
Putting your keys between your fingers is probably more common. Pretending or being on the phone with someone and saying, I will be there in 10 minutes.
Hold on, this is a pretend conversation.
Yeah, yeah. Or it's a real conversation, but the events you're talking about are pretend.
And the spacecraft sent to carry messages to alien life forms calls home from the furthest reaches of the galaxy. We'll find out how. The BBC News is read this morning by Jane Steele.
Emergency teams in Spain have been combing through stranded cars and abandoned buildings for some of the dozens and dozens of people that officials say are still missing after catastrophic flooding in the eastern Valencia region. Almost 160 are now known to have died, though it's feared that number will rise. There are accusations that the civil protection agencies weren't as ready as they could have been. From the city of Valencia, Bethany Bell sent this report.
Rescue teams are still searching for missing people. Spain's Minister of Territorial Policy, Ángel Víctor Torres, said it was still impossible to confirm how many were still unaccounted for. But he said the data was already absolutely horrifying. With every day, he said, the hopes of finding them alive diminish. Survivors have told us how they felt abandoned by the authorities. In a suburb of Valencia where the streets are caked with mud and debris, we met José Ramón. We don't see the army, he said. We don't see civil defence. We don't see machines cleaning. Solidarity doesn't exist.
GPs, care homes and hospices have voiced concerns that they will have to pay the higher employer national insurance contributions announced in the budget. They're not covered by the exemption for the public sector, as our political correspondent Hallie Farley reports.
The NHS was at the heart of Labour's first budget, and as part of the public sector, it will not have to pay the extra employer national insurance contributions. But other healthcare providers will. That will hit care homes and hospices particularly hard. There is also confusion over the impact on GP surgeries, many of which are run as small businesses. Last night, the Department of Health and Social Care said further details would be announced in due course. But the Chief Secretary to the Treasury, Darren Jones, told Question Time GPs would have to pay the hike in employer national insurance.
The man appointed by the Chancellor to advise the government on saving money will earn about £50,000 a year for working one day a week. The Treasury says David Goldston, the independent chair of the new Office for Value for Money, will be paid a day rate of £950. With 4 days left before the US presidential election, Kamala Harris and Donald Trump have been campaigning in the western battleground states of Nevada and Arizona. Ms. Harris has put the issue of abortion at the centre of her pitch to voters, characterising the election as a fight for women's freedom. At a rally in Nevada, Donald Trump criticised his rival's climate policy, claiming the Democratic Party wanted to cut emissions by getting rid of windows and cows.
I got to change my whole philosophy if you don't vote me in, because I'll go back to building crazy buildings now and I won't be able to use windows anymore. No, they don't want windows. They don't want cows. They don't want anything. They don't know what they want, actually.
Israeli warplanes have bombed Beirut's southern suburbs for the first time in days. Yesterday, 7 people, including 4 Thai farm workers, were killed by Hezbollah rocket fire on Israel, and 6 health workers were killed by Israeli attacks in southern Lebanon. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has met 2 US envoys trying to broker a deal to end the fighting. BBC News has found that the Metropolitan Police was told about allegations of sexual abuse by the former Harrods owner Mohammed Al-Fayed a decade earlier than Scotland Yard has recently acknowledged. A teenage girl, who has since died, reported him to the force in 1995. Until now, the Met has said its first report dated from 2005. Al-Fayed died last year and was never charged with any sexual offences. Daniel De Simone reports.
Samantha Ramsey was 17 when she reported Mohammed Al-Fayed to the Met in 1995 for sexually assaulting her in Harrods. The Met has accepted that 21 women reported Al-Fayed from 2005 until his death. But Samantha's report was a decade before. 60 further women have contacted the force in the past few weeks. The Met says there's no history of Samantha's case on its computer systems, but that paper-based reports from the 1990s might not have been digitised.
Researchers say cutting sugar in a child's first 1,000 days from conception to age 2 appears to reduce their risk of major diseases later in life. The study by the University of Southern California analysed the impact of ending sugar rationing in the UK after the Second World War. Here's our health and science correspondent James Gallagher.
The rationing of sugar and sweets ended in September 1953, and almost overnight, the amount of sugar in the nation's diet doubled. The study in the journal Science took advantage of this natural experiment. It looked at 60,000 people who were born either side of the end of sugar rationing, and they all grew up through the same societal changes through the following decades. But those spending their first 1,000 days in the era of sugar rationing, and that includes time in the womb, were 35% less likely to have type 2 diabetes and 20% less likely to have high blood pressure.
The US aerospace giant Boeing has made an improved pay offer to 33,000 factory workers who've been on strike for 7 weeks. The deal involves an increase of 38% over 4 years and a bonus, taking average salaries to almost $120,000 or £93,000. A noun whose first known use dates back to the early 1500s has been named by the Collins Dictionary as its word of the year. Brat hasn't been chosen for its traditional meaning, but a new usage popularised by the singer Charlie XCX. She used it as the name of her latest album, which redefined it as someone who is confident, independent and hedonistic.
Jane, thank you. Somehow if I call someone a brat on air, I don't know that that'll be the way that it's heard, but I'll bear it in mind. It's coming up to 6:08. Definitely not a brat. Or maybe she is. I don't know, Sarah. Keith Lucas, would you like to embrace the use of that word? Tell us about the weather.
Do you know what? I'm not sure anyone over the age of about 40 can change our mindset on that one, but I'll try, yes. Well, it was called a brat summer, apparently, this summer. But now we're well into autumn. The weather really feeling very autumnal out there. Not changing in a hurry, actually. We've got high pressure in charge. So most places, again, looking dry today. Limited amounts of sunshine. We have got a lot of cloud in the skies. It's across the north of Scotland that we've got some rain this morning, mainly to the north of the Murray Firth. That rain quite persistent. It will sink south across Scotland, but it's going to be fizzling out. So some light patchy rain and drizzle for central and southern Scotland later into the afternoon, with more sunshine returning from the north. But for the rest of the UK, Northern Ireland, England and Wales, staying dry today. A lot of cloud around, limited amounts of sunshine breaking through, but fairly light winds, and it's mild for most of us. 14 to 16 degrees, just a bit colder across the north of Scotland as the sunshine appears later on. And into the weekend, high pressure still sticking with us, so again, a lot of dry weather. Saturday still looking a little bit murky and cloudy, but we've got some slightly drier air moving in by Sunday, so we should see more sunshine on the way.
Thank you, Sarah. 6:08 is the time. Let's have our first look at the papers and the news website, several of them leading on a rise in the cost of government borrowing in response to the budget. Markets turn on Reeves over tax burden is the Daily Telegraph's headline. The paper says bond shares and the value of the pound have fallen in what it calls a rebuke to the Chancellor.
The Guardian says some analysts have sought to draw comparisons with Liz Truss's mini-budget when financial markets were thrown into a tailspin, but they noted that the gyrations in the city yesterday were far less substantial than those 2 years ago. The paper says the Bank of England and the Treasury are on high alert, monitoring the situation.
The Financial Times also says many in the city have played down any parallels with the Truss mini-budget. The paper says while a number of business figures have criticised tax rises, the chief executive of Barclays has praised ministers for, as he put it, doing an admirable job in balancing spending, borrowing and taxation in order to stimulate growth.
A kick in the bollocks is the Sun's front page headline. The paper says the Chancellor's decision to impose a 20% inheritance tax on land and machinery worth more than £1 million could lead to a dramatic drop in food production and supplies running low.
According to the Daily Mail, the Chancellor has taken a huge gamble with the economy. The paper says she is throwing obstacles in the way of business and risks replicating the stagnation afflicting Europe's major economies, which are eking out meagre growth at best.
The Times highlights a warning from the Office for Budget Responsibility that by the end of this Parliament, about a half of claims for the main welfare benefit will be for poor health. It means the total cost of sickness will climb to £100 billion a year. According to the article, experts believe that the soaring cost of sickness benefits is a key reason why the nation is paying more tax without receiving better public services, and they're urging the government to get a grip of the problem.
Here in the US, where I am this morning, the American papers concentrating on a visit by Kamala Harris's running mate Tim Walz to one of the battleground states, to Pennsylvania. It's highlighted by the Philadelphia Inquiry. It shows him celebrating Diwali at a Hindu temple, says he campaigned in the suburbs where shifts in the electorate could determine the national winner, something we will be coming back to later on in the program. The Washington Post says voters in Missouri may overturn one of the nation's strictest abortion bans. It's one of 10 states voting on initiatives related to abortion. The New York Times says Harris and Trump campaigns, both of them attacking each other over gender, with Ms. Harris seizing on her rival's statement that under him, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. would work on women's health.
And finally, back here, the Times says people who carry burning anger over small things that happened decades ago may have something in common with crows. Scientists at the University of Washington have found that the birds can harbour a grudge for as long as 17 years against those who upset or threaten them. The researchers say crows are either unable or unwilling to forgive and use their renowned intelligence and alarmingly good memory for faces to pursue and harangue their abusers. You have been warned.
It is 12 minutes past six. Who's ahead as we reach the final weekend of campaigning in America's utterly unpredictable, oh-so-close election? We are camped this morning in Pennsylvania, has 19 votes in the Electoral College. It's the biggest of the swing states. It could determine who goes to the White House. Here's a taste of what we're going to hear at more length later in the program. First from Sean Trendy, who is a polling expert at Real Clear Politics.
Pennsylvania looks to be the state, the whole ball of wax, as it were. That's the one state where Trump seems to be emerging with something of a lead in the polls. In the last few days, his lead in our average is almost up to a point. And so if he wins Pennsylvania, Harris has a really difficult time winning the Electoral College.
Much of the fight in this state and in other marginals as well, the swing states, is about young black men who used to vote reliably for the Democrats and still will this year. But the polls suggest in reduced numbers. Not true, says Councilman Isaiah Thomas, who is a Democrat on the Philadelphia City Council and chairman of Black Men for Kamala Harris in Pennsylvania.
The idea that we're going to continue this dialogue, that black men have been pulled away for Kamala Harris, as if black men are not going to be the second largest voting demographic for Kamala Harris on Tuesday, is something that's not only absurd, but it's disrespectful to black men.
No, but not as large as it has been. That's the point that people are making.
How do you know? You saw the future?
No, I've seen the polls.
So polls, what do polls mean? Polls told us that Donald Trump was going to lose, and he won. The polls aren't necessarily accurate.
Cliff Maloney runs a multi-million dollar campaign to get the Republican vote out in Pennsylvania. He is bullish about Donald Trump's appeal here.
Absolute net plus. I think the guy, you know, represents what a lot of people want, which is somebody that represents the blue collar, the working class. I think there is a huge political shift going on right now, unlike we've ever, probably since Obama.
We also hear from one of the most renowned chroniclers of politics here in Pennsylvania, Selena Zito, who doesn't rule out more surprises.
that so many things have changed in this election. He's been shot at. I was 4 feet away from him when that happened. A sitting president has walked away from running. So things are moving. Everything is unpredictable, right? Like nothing. Like I wake up every morning and you think, well, what fresh hell is going to happen today?
We bring you many tastes of that unpredictability in the next 3 hours.
I'm looking forward to hearing more of that, much more from Philadelphia throughout the programme. It is now 14 minutes past six. Cutting sugar from a baby's diet, even during pregnancy, cuts the risk of them suffering major diseases in later life. That's what scientists think we can learn from studying the impact of rationing all those decades ago. James Gallagher is our BBC health and science correspondent. Tell us more. What have scientists been doing, James?
Yeah, good morning. Look, this is a really kind of quite interesting study because there aren't many occasions when you can look at what happens if you double the amount of sugar that an entire population is eating. But that's what they've done in this analysis by going back to the end of rationing, sugar and sweets rationing in 1953. Now, the idea of this study was, well, if we take children born just before and just after the end of rationing, well, they're basically roughly the same. They're the same generation. They'll grow up through the same changes through the 60s, 70s, 80s and beyond. But they have that difference in early life. The ones just before would have been sugar rationed. The ones just after would have had free-flowing sugar. And so what's the difference when that bakes out over decades? Well, it's a 4-year delay in type 2 diabetes, a 2-year delay in the diagnosis of hypertension or high blood pressure, reductions of a third in type 2 diabetes, blood pressure by 20%, lower rates of obesity in those that grew up or were born or conceived in that era of sugar rationing. And it seems to be important both in the womb and into those early stages when we're having our first tastes and weaning onto solids.
Yeah, that's
there are
a fascinating
questions about
thing.
How definitive the research is, though.
Mm. Sorry, James, I was going to say the fascinating thing is in the womb as well as after birth.
Yeah, I mean, that does kind of fit in with lots of other bits of science. So kind of like one of the things around this is kind of like the science isn't completely definitive. You can't be definitive from this kind of study looking at what was happening in the 1950s and following it through. But you add it to the patchwork quilt of other bits of nutrition research, the animal research looking at this kind of field, what happens to mothers that develop gestational diabetes and to their children. And it does kind of fit into this picture of kind of like what is happening in the very earliest moments of our life is in some ways helping to shape our health across the whole of our lives, and that is a critical window right at the beginning of our lives.
James Gallagher, thank you. We'll talk about that some more in about an hour's time with the President of the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health.
Time now, 17 minutes past six. So is there panic on the financial markets or is there not as investors digest the fallout from the budget? More on that now and the rest of the day's business news from Felicity Hannah. Morning, Felicity.
Morning, yes. Well, let's talk about UK gilts. Yields there hit their highest levels of the year yesterday. That essentially means the interest the government pays on its debts. And yes, there is a question, of course, about whether that is in response to what Chancellor Rachel Reeves set out in her budget. Let's talk to Shanti Kellerman, Chief Investment Officer at M&G Wealth. Shanti, morning.
Good morning.
First of all, then, tell us what the gilt markets did this week.
So we saw the yield of gilts rise quite a bit yesterday, and I think that comes from digesting the budget. The things in there that probably make people that are investing in that debt a little cautious are Rachel Reeves changed the fiscal rules to give herself room to borrow more. And then the budget she announced actually is very much using up all of that headroom. And there's a bit of doubt on whether or not it'll raise the amount of revenue that she says it will. And also, will they be able to deliver some of the spending cuts that are in it? So that makes people think that we're actually might going to need to borrow more money than we're planning to borrow. And maybe we'll have to go back and do more tax rises. So I wouldn't say panic, certainly not in the gilt market, but definitely a bit of concern from investors on how these plans will balance out over the next couple of years.
But we're still not at the levels that we saw immediately after the Liz Truss mini budget.
Nope, still below those levels. And at least this time there's a clear plan about how it will be balanced. But one of the things that could derail that is if yields on government bonds rise and borrowing costs increase, that in itself could derail the plan and mean some of those targets aren't hit.
And of course, things like the Bank of England's interest rate decision next week, even global events like the US election, these can all play into how much it costs the British government to borrow.
Yes, absolutely. I think We also saw that expectations for interest rate cuts came back a little bit in the UK. The Office for Budget Responsibility said this will likely add a small amount to inflation, not a 0.5%. If inflation is a bit higher, then it means interest rates maybe can't go down as much as we would have hoped. But still on that downward trajectory, no one's from this budget thinking that interest rates won't fall any further from here.
Well, we'll be talking more about what's happening in the gilt markets after 7 o'clock on this programme. But Shanti, stay with us for now. I want to talk now about sales of car finance, which have come under scrutiny this week with an appeal ruling which establishes thousands of car buyers might have been charged interest they shouldn't have been paying. There's been some suggestions this could be the next PPI. UK lenders are scrambling to understand what impact a landmark Court of Appeal ruling into discretionary commission arrangements could mean for them. Essentially, these arrangements allowed motor finance brokers, usually car dealers, to earn extra commission from the lender by selling loans with higher interest rates to customers. And this week, there was a test case against two car finance companies that suggested these commissions were illegal, opening the floodgates potentially to billions of pounds worth of compensation claims. The two lenders involved in the judgment do say they intend to appeal. But let's talk to Stephen Hadrill, who's the Director General of the Finance and Leasing Association, which is the trade body for the motor finance sector. Stephen, you represent lenders that provided a collective 52 billion quid in car lending just last year. Good morning.
Good morning.
What does this test case mean for your members?
Well, it's a huge ruling. Actually, lending in this market is about 84 billion. It's the second biggest after mortgages. And there's about 6 million people who are benefiting from a loan of this kind at the moment.
Benefiting is a quite a loaded word to use at a time when a lot of people listening will think, well, hang on, doesn't this mean I was sold a loan at a higher rate so the dealer could earn extra commission that I wasn't told about?
No, what the court has said is that the commission should have been disclosed and the customer should have been asked to confirm that they assented to it. But it doesn't mean to say that they were paying more than they should have done. It's that they should have known what they were paying. So that the judgment is not quite as you were describing it. And it's an astonishing judgment because, you know, the industry has been operating in accordance with the regulator's requirements and understanding of the law forever. And now this judgment comes in and just overturns all that. And, you know, frankly, the industry has done really a rather extraordinary job over this week in trying to, yeah, change its processes and keep going, whilst at the same time calling for a review by the Supreme Court.
Well, the FCA has suggested that this has cost potentially 560,000 car loan customers an average of more than £500 a year each.
Well, the FCA did a review of this, which it concluded in 2019. And it did change some of the legislation on the way in which dealers were allowed to calculate or vary commission themselves. But it also said that it did not intend to take any action in relation to the disclosure of commission. It didn't think that there was any significant harm happening in that market.
How anxious will your members be now about potentially quite significant claims being in the pipeline?
Well, they're very anxious because this judgment has a retrospective effect. And that's why, as I was saying, we need the Supreme Court to review it. And I hope put us back into a situation where we have certainty in this market. At the moment, there is legal certainty has disappeared. And for a lending market to work well, it does need that certainty. Its investors, you know, need certainty as well. And the government talks about the need for investment in this country. Financial services provides the vehicle for that investment. And it's not going to operate well unless we have that kind of legal certainty. And this astonishing judgment is an example of quite the opposite of what we need.
Some listeners will think this is just your members' chickens coming home to roost.
No, I don't think that's true. I mean, because as I just said, the regulator themselves looked at this market and they did not conclude that action needed to be taken.
Stephen Hadrill, Director General of the Finance and Leasing Association, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, still listening to that is Shanti Kellerman. Shanti, pretty strong comments from the Finance and Leasing Association. There's also been pretty strong reaction in the markets and even some lenders delaying results.
Yes, so Santander delayed publication of their UKerry subsidiary. The messaging was a bit contradictory, and they said they felt it wasn't material, but then why would you delay your results if it wasn't? You also have seen Lloyd's shares down about 10% on the announcement, as they're active in the market. And the biggest play, one of the biggest players in this market is Close Brothers, a more specialist firm, down 37% in the past week. So investors are certainly taking it seriously and thinking there is going to be some changes or potentially redress.
Shanti Kellerman, thank you very much indeed. Now, Rachel Reeves continuously called it a budget for growth. One part of that, of course, is UK infrastructure and getting overseas companies to bring their money and invest it here in the UK. Companies like Aware Super, which is one of Australia's biggest pension funds. It has over £80 billion under management. And its chief executive, Dean Stewart, joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning, Felicity.
What did you think then about what was announced in the budget?
Look, we welcome the Chancellor's budget, certainly a significant budget this week. And I think particularly for us, as you just said, is the focus on long-term infrastructure investment. And I think the government's signalling of backing key industries such as clean energy and housing certainly instills confidence in foreign investors like Aware Super.
And Deanne, was there enough detail for you in the budget? Are you going to make different investment decisions as a result?
Look, at the end of the day, as long-term investors, we tend to look through one budget or one election cycle where we tend to invest for sort of 10, 20, 30 years. So I think the details are still yet to come. That being said, I think just the signalling and the clarity of focus that the government wants to put around clean energy is a positive sign. That won't stop us, quite frankly, investing significantly in these areas. The energy transition is one of the biggest themes happening right around the world. And already in the 1 year that we have created an office here in the UK, we've invested significant dollars in that space, investing a significant stake in Octopus, for example.
And do you see the UK as somewhere that's open for business? Because there's, you know, as you say, this green energy revolution is happening around the world. There's lots of different places you could put your money.
Yes, certainly. I mean, just to give you the context, Aware Super, as you mentioned, is one of the largest super funds. And now we're ticking up actually almost to £100 billion now. And so for us, we really wanted to open up our first international office. And when we looked around, the UK really was a important market for us to be in. It's certainly one of the most significant and largest financial capital markets. It has a really deep pool of talent. And certainly as an Aussie, an alignment of culture and language and rule of law. So it felt for us a very natural place to invest. And 1 year on, I have to say, we have found significant investment opportunities. And we feel that it has been a really good time to enter into the market, as the UK is sort of in that turning of where the economy is at. And so 1 year ago, we committed to investing just over $5 billion in the UK and Europe over the next 5 years. And really pleased to say that 1 year on, we've actually committed more than £2 billion in really significant investments in the energy transition, in digital infrastructure, and certainly in the real estate market as well.
Now, as you say, you take a very long-term view, but it's no secret the UK government's been courting global investors like you. What more could the UK do to bring more of that investment here?
Look, what I would say is investors love certainty. So ultimately, our role is to get the best risk-adjusted returns for our members for their retirements, and that really matters. And so ultimately what reduces risk is certainty and consistency of policy. So in terms of the UK government, I would certainly be advising that real clarity of policy around areas like clean energy, housing, digital infrastructure, but also consistency of that policy over a period of time as well, certainly helps from an investment market together with incentives and subsidies and what are other areas that they're looking to invest in.
Deanne Stewart from Aware Super, thank you very much indeed.
And Felice, thank you. It's coming up to 29 minutes past six. It's time for the sport. Here's Mike. Morning, Mike.
Morning, Nick. Thank you. Good morning. Let me bring you news of a heavy defeat for England's cricketers in the Caribbean. They lost the first one-day international with the West Indies by 8 wickets last night. The story of the match comes from Daniel Norcross.
A callow, inexperienced England team containing four debutants was soundly thrashed by the West Indies in the first one-day international in Antigua. Put into bat on an awkward but far from treacherous surface, England lost wickets at regular intervals. Jaden Seals accounted for openers Phil Salt and Will Jacks, and although 21-year-old Jacob Bethel briefly impressed with 27 and stand-in captain Liam Livingstone combined with Sam Curran for a fifth wicket partnership of 72, they were unable to handle the left-arm spin of Gutikesh Moti, who took 4 for 41. 209 all out inside 45 overs was never going to be enough. And although the weather threatened to come to their rescue, Evan Lewis found enough time in between the showers to rain down 8 sixes on the mostly English crowd and a scintillating 69-ball 94. And although he perished attempting to reach his 100 with another 6, the West Indies cantered to a convincing and well-deserved 8-wicket win with 55 balls to spare. As for England, they know they will have to be much, much better if they're to stay in the series when the sides next meet on Saturday.
Elsewhere in Mumbai, it is day one of the third test between India and New Zealand, with the tourists 92 for 3 at lunch. Next, shall we hear from the presumptive new manager of Manchester United? Ruben Amorim is currently the head coach of Sporting Lisbon and spoke yesterday at a pre-match press conference in Portugal, where he said discussions with United are ongoing, but that an agreement was close.
It's a negotiation between two clubs. It's never easy, even with the clauses. It's never easy. They have to talk. And we'll have clarification after the game. It will be very clear. So it's one more day after the game tomorrow. We'll have the decision made.
Ruud van Nistelrooy will continue as interim manager of Manchester United for their match with Chelsea in the Premier League this weekend. Meanwhile, the FA Cup first round starts this evening. 32 non-league clubs still in the competition at this stage, and we will talk to one of them later in the programme. Finally, big shock at the Paris Masters tennis yesterday. Carlos Alcaraz is out. The Wimbledon champion was beaten by the 15th seed and home favourite Hugo Humbert. Also out, sadly, from a British perspective, is Jack Draper. His 7-match winning streak ended in the third round in Paris by the 9th seed Alex de Minaur of Australia. That defeat also ends Draper's faint chances of sneaking into the season-ending ATP finals.
A shame. Thanks, Mike.
Join Americast on the road to the US election.
It's the BBC podcast full of lively chats about politics,
with social media investigations
and experts on the ground.
We'll guide you through all the key moments as the United States chooses which direction to go in next.
Navigate your way to Election Day and beyond.
Americast.
Listen on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Do indeed, but not until today is over. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson in London, Justin Webb in Philadelphia. It is 28 minutes to 7. Jane Steele has the news.
Emergency teams in Spain have been scouring the eastern Valencia region for dozens of people still missing after this week's catastrophic flooding. Hundreds of troops have been deployed to help with the rescue efforts. At least 158 people are known to have died, though it's feared that number will rise. There are accusations that the civil protection agencies weren't as ready as they could have been. GPs, care homes and hospices have voiced concerns that they will have to pay the higher employer national insurance contributions announced in the budget. They're not covered by the exemption for the public sector. Hospices argue those providing NHS services should be treated the same as NHS bodies. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump have been campaigning in the western battleground states of Nevada and Arizona in the final days of the presidential election. Ms. Harris has been focusing on reproductive rights and has criticized her Republican counterpart for his remarks about women. Donald Trump has been reiterating his 2020 allegations about voter fraud. BBC News has found that reports of sexual abuse about the former Harrods owner Mohammed Al-Fayed were made to the Metropolitan Police a decade earlier than has recently been acknowledged. Samantha Ramsey reported him to the force in 1995 when she was 17. She has since died. Until now, the Met has said its first report dated from 2005. The force says there's no history of Samantha Ramsey's case on its computer systems, but that paper-based reports from the 1990s might not have been digitised. Researchers say cutting sugar in a child's first 1,000 days from conception to age 2 appears to reduce their risk of developing chronic diseases later in life. The study by the University of Southern California analysed the impact of ending sugar rationing in the UK after the Second World War. Those who'd consumed less sugar as young children had a 35% lower risk of developing type 2 diabetes.
Jane, thank you very much indeed. 26 minutes to 7 now. More fallout from this week's budget. Businesses, not workers, should pay to rescue the NHS was the Chancellor's central argument for her big budget tax hike. But amongst those businesses counting the cost of higher national insurance are GP practices and care homes. Helen Catt is our political correspondent. Might surprise some people to learn, Helen, it came up on Question Time last night, didn't it, that GPs are amongst those who will pay more.
Yeah, if this is a budget to boost investment, particularly in public services and the health service, the NHS, then it seems pretty obvious that the Chancellor isn't going to want to immediately lose a chunk of that money back to the Treasury by having to pay this hike. And so there is an exemption built into it for public sector organisations and the NHS. But the problem has come with these parts of the health sector, which are not part of the NHS, but do provide key bits of NHS services and key health services. So private businesses like care homes, like hospices, who are not covered by this, but also potentially GPs. And there's a bit of confusion about the situation around GPs. Many surgeries are run as private businesses. And the Department of Health and Social Care has said that it will be releasing further details about GPs in due course, officials suggesting that there'll be work to ensure appropriate compensation. But on Question Time last night, the Chief Secretary to the Treasury, Darren Jones, said that GPs would have to pay the hike. And we are getting warnings this morning from the Doctors' Union, the BMA, last night rather, saying that that will have a monumental impact on surgeries across the country.
And indeed, at 10 to 7, we're going to be hearing from someone who runs a GP practice and also from someone running a care home about their worries. Meantime, ministers, I suspect, Helen, have got a nervy eye on what the markets might do next when they open this morning.
Yeah, I think there's going to be some quite closer watching from the Treasury of what the markets do, because we saw yesterday bond yields rise to their highest level in a year. They went above 4.5% before falling back. Now, Rachel Reeves did tell Bloomberg TV yesterday that the government's number one commitment was economic and fiscal stability. She said that they have put the public finances on a stable and solid trajectory. And just for context, when we were not seeing the sort of spike that we saw Liz Truss style after the mini budget, but analysts are saying that this upward movement in the cost of borrowing for the government does suggest there is some nervousness and some unhappiness in the market about the levels of borrowing and spending. So I think it might be a few fingernails bitten in the Treasury over the next couple of days.
Thanks, Helen. Yes, more on that in the next hour once those markets do open at 24 minutes to 7. What time is it where you are, Justin? You've had a very, very long day since you arrived in the States.
I'm not even thinking about it, but we're on the way to 3 o'clock in the morning. But never mind, because here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, as it is properly known, there is hair being torn out on both sides of America's political divide, probably long into the night. Here and around the nation as well. And Emma Vardy is our correspondent in Arizona, out to the west, where both Trump and Harris have been campaigning. And saying what, Emma?
Well, in the closing days of this campaign, we've been seeing, as you might expect, each side taking every opportunity to paint a dismal picture of America if the other one wins. Now, Kamala Harris appearing in Arizona today, she particularly has been putting abortion rights front and center of her campaign. She lays the blame at Donald Trump's door for his actions, which she says led to the overturning of Roe v. Wade, which was overturning women's constitutional rights to abortion. Trump, meanwhile, Donald Trump, he's been appearing. We know he turns down more traditional broadcast interviews. He's been appearing in Arizona with the controversial former Fox News host Tucker Carlson. He's been repeating his many, often repeated, unfounded claims that the 2020 election was rigged. He said these many times. He talked about there being cheating in the upcoming election. He knows that is something his supporters believe. Of course, his critics say that for months he's been paving the ground to claim it's fraud once again if he loses.
Emma, there was a feeling, wasn't there, that in the last few days of the campaign, possibly the polls would begin to tell us something useful. In other words, one of the two of them would have forged ahead a bit. But that hasn't really happened, has it?
if the polls are correct, then this is shaping up to be the closest presidential race in modern times. The polls show they've moved very little in the battleground states over the past month. The margins are just so, so tight. A lot of this will be down to getting the voters to the polls. Who will be able to do that? The Democrats feel that because abortion is on the ballot in 10 states, that they're hoping this means they'll get a greater number of female voters out. Perhaps that's something not being picked out by the polls at the moment. There is some indication that Kamala Harris has a lead with female voters, that Donald Trump appears to have a lead with male voters, but it is so, so close, you wouldn't want to call it.
Emma Vardy in Phoenix, thank you.
It is now 21 minutes to seven, and let's turn to the terrible floods in Spain, which have turned the streets of Valencia into a sea of mud filled with washed up cars. Worse in some of the villages, small towns surrounding it. Our correspondent in Valencia is Andrew Harding, and they're now looking for the missing, Andrew.
Morning, Nick. Yes, searching through those piles of cars that you must have seen, such extraordinary images here, particularly in the suburbs of Valencia. The death toll at the moment still standing at 158, but officials are saying many dozens more people are missing. And so it's a mixture of rescue work, people still hunting for survivors, perhaps, but the dead particularly, and also the grim task of clearing up the mud which cakes everything, and of supporting families who have lost so much because of the torrential rain and the speed of the torrent as well. That today, for instance, it's a clear morning, no clouds visible where I am, and yet that's exactly the problem, that the rain came elsewhere and people in Valencia were taken totally by surprise because they hadn't seen the rain and therefore they didn't anticipate the flash flood coming down the rivers so fast.
It is the speed that seems to have been the big factor here, Andrew, isn't it? Because, you know, normally we see extraordinary images during floods of water in the streets. There aren't that many images, are there? There's an awful lot of images, very powerful pictures of the aftermath, not that much of the flood. Were people just caught completely unawares?
Well, this is where public education has to change and has to play such a role, because people need to understand that it doesn't need to rain where you are for there to be a very, very dangerous flood. And people need to be told they must not get in their cars, which may be the natural thing to do. But as we've seen, those cars become death traps on clogged, undrivable roads. And people need to know that they need to go to higher ground, and they need to know where that higher ground is. And the most vulnerable people need, of course, to be taken upstairs or to places of safety. Instead, the warnings, although there were warnings, there were flood warnings, they clearly didn't carry the urgency that that they needed to.
Andrew Harding in Valencia. More from the aftermath of those terrible floods later in the programme. Thank you.
18 minutes to 7 is the time. Let's have a look at the papers, and why don't I kick off with what at least a couple of them are saying here in the United States. An interesting front page on the Wall Street Journal about the way in which the American economy and the most powerful companies in it seem to power ahead in spite of all the kind of chaos of the politics that we so regularly talk about, and indeed are going to talk about during the course of the rest of this program. So the Wall Street Journal saying some of the world's biggest tech companies showed this week how the tens of billions of dollars that they've bet on the artificial intelligence boom are starting to pay off. They're warning as well that bigger investments are coming. So this is cloud businesses at Amazon, at Microsoft, at Google, reaching a huge amount of $62.9 billion last quarter, up 22% from the same period last year, marking at least the fourth straight quarter, the Wall Street Journal says, in which their combined growth has managed to carry on in spite, as I say, of all the politics. And turning to the politics, why the right thinks Trump is running away with the race is a headline in the New York Times, which they say is due to skewed polls and anonymous betting markets that are building up Republicans' expectations. Donald Trump, they say, could use that to challenge the result if it goes against him.
The papers here at home focus on the fallout of the budget. The Telegraph, markets turn on Reeves over tax burden. The FT puts it in a kind of more moderated way. Borrowing costs tick up is the phrase it uses as investors digest Reeves' budget debt demands, saying that borrowing costs after the budget have raised to the highest level this year. People will be watching those markets when they open at 7 a.m. this morning. The way the eye put it is interest rates will fall more slowly after the budget. Economist warns there are other warnings too. The Guardian says Reeves told she'll have to raise a further £9 billion for public services. The Mail highlights Reeves' tax rate to cost charities, it says, £1.4 billion a year. The time now is coming up to 16 minutes to 7. The Shadow Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, had a non-speaking role on Budget Day, but he finally got to say his piece yesterday in Parliament. We heard from him on the programme here, of course, yesterday, when in the Commons he accused Labour of breaking election promises about tax. But his record at the Treasury came under attack when a Labour minister accused him of a dereliction of duty. With more, here's our correspondent, Sean Curran.
There are lots of parliamentary conventions. Some are hard and fast rules. Others are tradition. One is that it's the leader of the opposition who replies to the budget speech. The shadow chancellor doesn't get to have their say until day two.
I now call the shadow chancellor Jeremy Hunt.
Yeah! Thank you, Madam Deputy Speaker. It's a pleasure to open this day of the budget debate with you in the chair for what will be my last contribution as Shadow Chancellor, something I'm aware may be a relief to the benches in front of me and possibly behind as well.
Having had plenty of time to mull things over, he was ready to deliver his verdict on the proposal set out by Rachel Reeves on Wednesday.
Yesterday's budget was the biggest tax-raising budget in British history. It was a huge tax on business and takes our tax burden up to German levels for the first time.
He was challenged by a Lib Dem, Max Wilkinson, who said he'd been talking to local businesses and his constituency.
They had two pieces of feedback. The first was that they were very worried about some of the announcements yesterday in terms of reliefs and also national insurance. And the second was that it wasn't as bad as the Liz Truss budget. I wonder whether he preferred yesterday's budget or the Liz Truss one.
The former Chancellor paused before replying.
I actually like neither, but I will say this. I was the person who reversed the decisions made in the mini-budget. But I will say this, at least Liz Truss wanted to grow the economy and said so explicitly.
The Cabinet Office Minister, Pat McFadden, began by paying tribute to Jeremy Hunt.
The Right Honourable Gentleman has confirmed that this is his last appearance at the dispatch box, at least in his current guise. So let me begin by thanking him for his service to government and to the country.
Pleasantries out of the way, the Minister turned to politics.
He was appointed Chancellor as the repairman, the adult in the room. He was meant to sort things out after the disaster left by his predecessor. He was supposed to be the antidote to Liz Truss. But in recent days, he's become an ally of Liz Truss.
And Pat McFadden went on to complain that the Conservatives had made a series of spending announcements when in government, but hadn't set aside the money to pay for them.
This was an irresponsible dereliction of duty that has left us picking up the pieces and him attacking the independent watchdog that was set up by his own party.
That was a reference to Jeremy Hunt's pre-budget criticism of the Office for Budget Responsibility, which oversees the government's spending plans. For the Liberal Democrats, Sarah Olney welcomed many of the budget announcements, but said she was concerned by the decision to increase employers' national insurance contributions.
I fear that this will be deeply damaging to many already struggling small businesses and care providers. So we urge the government to at least consider exempting social care from the employer's national insurance tax rise. The Chancellor has provided extra funding for the NHS and other public sector organisations to cover the cost of the tax rise. However, the vast majority of care providers are in the private sector and so won't benefit from this help.
There are 335 new MPs. One of them, Labour's Chris Vince, rose from his place to challenge Sarah Olney.
Do you not think that the fact that you're supporting all of the spending commitments but not supporting any of the tax rises is the reason that the Lib Dems will never be in government?
He'd fallen foul of the Deputy Speaker, Nusrat Ghani.
You said you twice. Oh, I'm so sorry. Twice. I'm so sorry, ma'am. I'm not going to allow you to stand again.
He'd broken one of those hard and fast parliamentary rules. MPs can't address one another as you. They're supposed to say the honourable member, something Chris Vince is unlikely to forget in a hurry.
Sean Curran would never forget. So you can hear more of his report on events yesterday in Parliament at 9 o'clock on Radio 4 Extra and on digital radio.
Time now is 8:07. We're in Philadelphia this morning for a reason. This is the biggest city and the most populous of the so-called swing states. 19 electoral college votes, which will go to the winner here. And that will almost certainly mean that they win the whole thing. Trump won it by less than a percentage point in 2016. Biden won it back by just over one percentage point in 2020. So who will win here in 24 and why? What swings the political swingers in this state? Selena Zito is the Washington Examiner's Pennsylvania reporter, a legendary chronicler of this state, it is fair to say. She's lived here all her life. She's visited all 67 local voting areas, the counties this time round during the campaign.
So Pennsylvania is a very fat, very wide state. If you are in the east of Pennsylvania, it's much more like New York and New Jersey. But as soon as you get out, maybe 20 minutes outside of Philadelphia, and you start getting into counties like Bucks County and Lancaster and York, it is much more agricultural and industrial. If you're in York or Lancaster County, it is considered the snack belt or the snack capital of the world, where 90% of the snacks in the country are made in that area because of the rich agriculture and the manufacturing.
So what does all of that do to the politics of it?
So the politics of it makes the cities, Philadelphia more so than Pittsburgh, liberal. The further you are, the deeper you are into the cities, the more progressive, the more far left that it gets. Where the other counties are pretty much center right. There's a lot of old members of the New Deal coalition, which are conservative Democrats who are pro-gun, pro-life. And so they're much more conservative than their cousins in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. So basically, Pittsburgh and Philadelphia are blue dots and the rest of the state is red, with the exception of some of the counties outside of Philadelphia. As people have moved up and out of the city, they have made those counties somewhat more blue.
Who's going to win?
I would rather be him than her in Pennsylvania at this moment. He has just done a better job talking about the most important things in the state, and that's the economy, that's immigration. And people are really just suffering with their pocketbooks. Yes, inflation has gone down, but the prices have not. They're still way up there. And it's not 9%, it's 15, 16, 17, 18% more expensive than it was 4 years ago. That impacts a budget. So I would put him in the favor at this moment. Now, we all know that so many things have changed in this election. He's been shot out. I was 4 feet away from him when that happened. A sitting president has walked away from running. Someone that was not elected by their primary voters was put in his place. So things are moving. Everything is unpredictable, right? Like nothing. Like I wake up every morning and you think, well, what fresh hell is going to happen today? Because that's what this cycle has been like.
Including among the unpredictable things, what actually happens on election night in Pennsylvania? Because if it's very close, Selena, are we looking at a result and possibly then a national result, which hinges on Pennsylvania just being unknowable, what, for days?
Well, 4 years ago, we were in the middle of COVID. And that impacted so many things, including when we got the results. However, people have gotten a lot better. It's the counties, they've all, for the most part, adopted pretty good systems to get the mail-in ballots counted at when it's 8 o'clock, and then they start counting the ballots that came in on election day. I mean, the only county that struggles, and we're going to be paying attention to this, is Philadelphia.
That's really interesting. You think then, with all your knowledge of Pennsylvania, you think there is a good chance, do you, that it will be called in the early morning after the election?
I'm hopeful. I'd like to think that these county officials want to do a good job and don't want a bad mark on the state or on their county. I'm hopeful that we might know at our time, maybe 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning.
Salida Zito, reporter in Pittsburgh for the Washington Examiner and legendary, I think it is fair to say, chronicler of the affairs of Pennsylvania. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
6 minutes to 7. The Metropolitan Police were told of allegations of sexual assault by Mohammed Al-Fayed a decade earlier than they've acknowledged in recent statements. That's the finding of a new BBC investigation. Our correspondent is Daniel DeSimone. Tell us more, Daniel. What have you found?
Well, so that's right. So Samantha Ramsey was a 17-year-old girl from Hampshire who moved to London in 1995 to pursue her dream of working in Harrods and quickly got a job there. And she was subjected quite quickly to a sexual assault by Mohammed Al-Fayed in his office after being invited there. And then after she reported it to a supervisor, she was put in a room with the supervisor, Mohammed Al-Fayed, and berated, fired and threatened and told not to tell anyone about it. But she did. She went to the Met Police about a day after and went into the police station and reported it. And we've been speaking to Samantha's family. Samantha died some years ago, very sadly. But her sister Emma describes what happened when she went into the police station.
She passed Marylebone Police Station and she just went straight in. I know she was told that, OK, we will take this down, we'll write this down, and we'll add it to a pile of other female names that we've got that have made the same complaint against Mohammed Al-Fayed. Nothing could be done, it's your word against his. She left, despondent. She'd done the right thing, reported it, but we never heard a thing back. Ever.
Her family were so disturbed by the response from the Met that they went to their local force in Hampshire, raised concerns there. We've spoken to an officer from the Time who corroborates this. The family say that this really changed the course of Samantha's life. She was very distressed by not being believed and what happened. And that she died in 2007 in a car crash. Why this is important in relation to the Met now is the Met, after the BBC film in September, which exposed so much about Al-Fayed, the Met has said that it's found allegations from 21 women that it received while he was alive. And they've said that that dates back, the earliest complaint, to 2005. What we found is that this allegation was made in 1995, so it's a decade earlier. So that kind of brings it much earlier and raises questions about what else the Met has received over the years that it's almost unaware of now.
And you've obviously put that to them. What are the Met now saying?
Well, the Met haven't denied this. They've said that they've searched their computer systems and they can't find a record of Samantha's case. But they're also saying that paper-based reports from the 90s, of which there were many, haven't necessarily been digitised and transferred onto their current systems. In their statement, they're more contrite than they have been in previous statements, I think it's fair to say. They're saying that whilst we cannot change what has happened, we do acknowledge that trust and confidence is affected by our approach in the past and are determined to do better. And they have really now a big investigation relating to Al-Fayed. You know, he's dead, so he can't be charged. But they are looking at other people who may be potentially implicated in what happened. And they've had 60 women that have come forward in the past few weeks to report their what happened to them.
Daniel DeSimone, thank you very much indeed. Obviously, the detail of that BBC investigation you'll find on BBC News Online.
Time now, 3 minutes to 7. And next week, news that can bring people together or drive them apart.
In the first series of The Gift, I looked at the truths that can be exposed when people take at-home DNA tests. Now, I'm going deeper into their unintended consequences, their life-changing aftershocks.
She looked at me and said, "You mean you're not my real mum?"
The stories I unearthed this time have been unlike anything I've heard before.
And he said, "Hi, sis." And then he says, "Come on, come and meet mum." So I went in the house and she was there.
The new series of The Gift with me, Jenny Kleeman, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds starts next Wednesday morning at 9:30.
Now, with the weather forecast, here's Sarah Keith Lucas.
Thank you, Nick. Well, the weather is not changing in a hurry at the moment. We've got high pressure holding on to the weather. So for most of us, it's looking dry and settled today and for the next few days. But there's just a weak front in the north, and that's bringing a bit of rain to parts of Scotland today. So we'll start with the north of Scotland and hear some fairly persistent rain actually first thing this morning. It's going to push its way further south. So by the afternoon, a return to some sunnier skies here, but it's going to feel quite chilly. 8 or 9 degrees this morning, but temperatures by the afternoon across the north of Scotland, just 5 or 6. Central and southern Scotland, largely dry, certainly over the next few hours, but cloudy. Then it does turn a little bit drizzly, some light rain just arriving later on in the afternoon, but still mild here at around 14 degrees. But for all of England, Wales and Northern Ireland, a very quiet weather picture. We've got a lot of cloud, a bit of hill fog around this morning, a little bit of mistiness around too. That should gradually clear away. Some holes in the cloud will develop, so the odds a bit of sunshine here and there, but it is going to be pretty limited, I think. 14 to 16 degrees, still on the mild side with light winds. And then as we head through tonight and into the weekend, there'll be a little bit of mist and fog reforming once again. Saturday, pretty similar to today, but less in the way of wet weather in the north. So we're looking at a largely dry picture with a lot of cloud around on Saturday. By the time we get to Sunday, some slightly drier air starts to move in. So again, a dry, settled picture, but we should see a little bit more in the way of sunshine breaking through by Sunday.
Sarah, thank you for that. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4, Nick Robinson in London and Justin Webb in Philadelphia.
Good morning from London and from Philadelphia. It is 7 o'clock on Friday, the 1st of November. The headlines this morning: rescue teams in Spain are still searching for dozens of people missing after the floods, which officials say have caused a horrifying loss of life. We'll have more from on the ground in Valencia after this bulletin. GP surgeries, care homes and hospices are warning that they could be hit hard by the budget because they've not been exempted from the tax rise for employers. And BBC News has found that the Metropolitan Police was told about sex abuse allegations against Mohammed Al-Fayed a decade earlier than the force has so far acknowledged.
And also coming up in this hour, I am in Philadelphia, the biggest city and the biggest swing state in the US election, where Donald Trump is trying to peel off Democratic voters.
Whatever else you might say about Donald Trump, he's fun. Or he can be fun, I guess. He can poke fun at himself. He can do things that would make any other politician seem ridiculous, like dress up like a garbage man and get in a garbage truck.
And?
Hello from the children of planet Earth.
It's the spacecraft sent to carry messages to alien life forms. It has called home from the furthest reaches of the solar system. We will find out how. The BBC News read this morning by Jane Steele.
Emergency teams in Spain have been combing through stranded cars and abandoned buildings for some of the dozens and dozens of people officials say are still missing after catastrophic flooding in the eastern Valencia region. Almost 160 people are now known to have died, though it's feared that number will rise. The regional government has announced more than £200 million worth of aid for those affected, but there are accusations that civil protection agencies weren't fully prepared. From the city of Valencia, Bethany Bell sent this report.
Rescue teams are still searching for missing people. Spain's Minister of Territorial Policy, Ángel Víctor Torres, said it was impossible to confirm how many were still unaccounted for. But he said the data was already absolutely horrifying. With every day, he said, the hopes of finding them alive diminish. Survivors have told us how they felt abandoned by the authorities. In a suburb of Valencia where the streets are caked with mud and debris, we met José Ramón. We don't see the army, he said. We don't see civil defence. We don't see machines cleaning. Solidarity doesn't exist. There are fears that some of these scenes could be repeated further south. In the city of Jerez, hundreds of families have been evacuated from their homes as heavy rain raises river levels.
GPs, care homes and hospices have voiced concerns that they will have to pay the higher employer national insurance contributions announced in the budget. They're not covered by the exemption for the public sector, as our political correspondent Harry Farley reports.
The NHS was at the heart of Labour's first budget, and as part of the public sector, it will not have to pay the extra employer national insurance contributions. But other healthcare providers will. That will hit care homes and hospices particularly hard, with Hospice UK arguing those providing NHS services should be treated the same as NHS bodies. There is also confusion over the impact on GP surgeries, many of which are run as small businesses. Last night, the Department of Health and Social Care said further details would be announced in due course. Officials added they would work to ensure appropriate compensation for the public sector. But the Chief Secretary to the Treasury, Darren Jones, told Question Time GPs would have to pay the hike in employer national insurance. That, said GPs, would have a monumental impact on surgeries across the country.
The man appointed by the Chancellor to advise the government on saving money will earn about £50,000 a year for working one day a week. The Treasury says David Goldston, the independent chair of the new Office for Value for Money, will be paid a day rate of £950. With just 4 days to go to the US presidential election, Donald Trump and Kamala Harris have been campaigning in the battleground states of Arizona and Nevada. At a rally in Las Vegas, Ms. Harris was endorsed by the singer Jennifer Lopez, who appeared with her. The vice president has put the issue of abortion at the centre of her pitch to voters, framing the election as a fight for women's freedom. Our correspondent Emma Vardy sent this report from Phoenix.
Addressing voters in Arizona, Kamala Harris told crowds that she would guarantee access to abortion nationwide if she was elected president. The procedure has been banned and heavily restricted in a number of US states. And at her rallies, she's laid the blame with Donald Trump, saying it was his actions which led to the overturning of women's constitutional right to abortion. Kamala Harris was particularly hoping to take her message to Latino voters in Arizona, where they make up around a quarter of the electorate. Donald Trump was also campaigning in a state he narrowly lost in 2020. He appeared on stage with the controversial former Fox News host Tucker Carlson, where he doubled down on unfounded claims of election fraud in 2020 and emphasised the need for a wall along the southern border with Mexico.
BBC News has found that the Metropolitan Police was told about allegations of sexual abuse by the former Harrods owner Mohammed Al-Fayed a decade earlier than Scotland Yard has recently acknowledged. A teenage girl reported him to the force in 1995. Until now, the Met has said its first report dated from 2005. Al-Fayed died last year and was never charged with any sexual offences. Daniel De Simone reports.
Samantha Ramsey was 17 when she reported Mohammed Al-Fayed to the Met in 1995 for sexually assaulting her in Harrods. She has since died, but her family say the Met dismissed her report. They believe multiple women could have been saved from sexual abuse if the force had acted. Since a BBC film in September exposed rape and abuse by Al-Fayed, the Met has accepted that 21 women reported him from 2005 until his death. But Samantha's report was a decade before, meaning the Met knew about him much earlier. The force says there's no history of Samantha's case on its computer systems, but that paper-based reports from the 1990s might not have been digitised.
Israeli warplanes have bombed the southern suburbs of the Lebanese capital Beirut for the first time in nearly a week. Yesterday, seven people, including four Thai farm workers, were killed by Hezbollah rocket fire on Israel, and six health workers were killed by Israeli attacks in southern Lebanon. From Jerusalem, here's our Middle East correspondent Yulan Nell.
Footage shows explosions followed by clouds of smoke over southern Beirut, a stronghold of Hezbollah, after the Israeli military told people in several buildings to leave. As intense fighting continues between Israel and Hezbollah, Washington has been leading the diplomatic push for a ceasefire. Yesterday, Israel's prime minister is said to have told two visiting US envoys that Israel's ability to counter threats to its security from Lebanon and return displaced citizens to the north were key elements of any ceasefire deal. Reports suggest that talks are centred on a 60-day pause to allow for the implementation of a long-violated UN Security Council resolution. That requires Hezbollah to withdraw its fighters from the very south of Lebanon.
Botswana's president, Mokgweetsi Masisi, has admitted defeat in the general election after preliminary results showed his Botswana Democratic Party had lost its parliamentary majority. The BDP has governed the country for nearly six decades since independence from Britain. The party's support was weakened by an economic slowdown, high unemployment and accusations of corruption. Researchers say cutting sugar in a child's first 1,000 days from conception to age 2 appears to reduce their risk of major diseases later in life. The study by the University of Southern California analysed the impact of ending sugar rationing in the UK after the Second World War. Here's our health and science correspondent James Gallagher.
The rationing of sugar and sweets ended in September 1953, and almost overnight, the amount of sugar in the nation's diet doubled. The study in the journal Science took advantage of this natural experiment. It looked at 60,000 people who were born either side of the end of sugar rationing, and they all grew up through the same societal changes through the following decades. But those spending their first 1,000 days in the era of sugar rationing, and that includes time in the womb, were 35% less likely to have type 2 diabetes and 20% less likely to have high blood pressure. This type of historical analysis can never be definitive, but the researchers say it fits with the wider medical evidence on the importance of our early life to our future health.
A noun whose first known use dates back to the early 1500s has been named by the Collins Dictionary as its word of the year. Brat hasn't been chosen for its traditional meaning, but a new usage popularised by the singer Charlie XCX. It's the name of her latest hit album, which redefined it as someone who is confident, independent and hedonistic. Other words that made it onto the list include era, inspired by another pop star, Taylor Swift, and delulu, meaning utterly mistaken or unrealistic.
Worth knowing. Jane, thank you very much indeed. It's 7:09. I look out the window and the first thing I see is cars floating down the street where I live. It was really surreal. So said one of those caught up in the worst flash floods in Spain in a generation. Streets turned into rivers, cars swept along in the tide, people watching helplessly as the water rose at extraordinary speed, as high as the balconies of their flats and their houses. The death toll has already reached 160. Dozens of people are still missing and feared dead after a year's worth of rain fell in 8 hours in parts of the Valencia region. In a moment, we'll speak to one of the reporters there who's been helping out with the rescue effort. First, our correspondent Bethany Bell sent us this from her eyewitness report from that region.
This is the village of Aldaya, not very far from Valencia, and their cars piled up against one another, debris all over the roads. You can see a chest and chairs that have been removed from a little business here. There's an old sofa just abandoned by the side of the road. On the street, I met José Ramón and his wife, Amparo. They told me there'd been no help, and they felt forgotten.
We feel very abandoned. We are abandoned. We don't see the army. We don't see civil defence. We don't see machines cleaning. Solidarity doesn't exist. No one has come. We've seen people in their balconies drinking a beer, and they wouldn't come down with a broom. There's no solidarity. That's why we feel that bad. Either from the government or the people, no one. That's it. We feel bad and abandoned. We've been putting the debris in the middle of the street. When are they coming to take it? We don't see anyone coming.
Overhead, the sky is cloudy and seen a number of lightning flashes. People here are worried that there's going to be even more rain. Officials still don't know exactly how many people are still missing. Earlier today, in another village not too far from here, we saw bodies being recovered from mud-filled streets and buildings. One man there told me that everybody knows somebody who's lost somebody.
Bethany Bell reporting there. Now, listening to that is a journalist who lives in the city of Valencia and yesterday went out on foot to the worst flood-affected regions. Paco Pollitt joins us on the line. Good morning to you. I know you walked just, a few kilometres into some of those smaller suburbs, the villages around Valencia. What did you see?
Good morning. Utter devastation. It's true that all of the roads are blocked, and the only way of reaching those southern smaller towns and areas and neighborhoods lies on, you know, walking and going on foot. And yesterday, actually, the scenes were of thousands, I would say thousands of Valencia citizens, especially those who live in the uptown area, downtown, you know, the northern side of the city, just trying to go south and helping out us as much as possible, carrying over with them plenty of bottled water, basic needs items, food, and so on. Because as you said, the situation is very worrying. I was listening to the witness by our peer, and it's true, the scenes that I saw over in Paiporta, which is another one of the smaller towns being you know, affected the most by the storms was very similar. I'd say even worse, because it was one of the points where the storm hit the hardest.
And Pekka, people seem to have been caught by surprise, even in an area used to very heavy rains. The warning came very, very late.
Yeah, it came very late. I think that the biggest criticism, which is going to be directed at the local authorities and the officials over here in the Valencian region, lies within the fact that there were, you know, prevention reports 5-6 days ago coming from the weather forecasts and so on, saying that the level of the water, the floods, the potential rains were going to be devastating last Tuesday. And with that kind of prevention on top of the table, action didn't ensue. And actually, when the alert was set off in our mobile phones over here, it was already 8:30 p.m. On Tuesday, when, you know, it had been raining for 2-3 hours and it was already too late.
Yeah, it's shocking to see the scenes there. Pekka Pollitt, thank you very much indeed for describing that to us. I mean, if you've seen those images of the cars, it is extraordinary. And there's one description I was just reading here of someone sitting in a car with the brakes on. The car starts to move and move at speed thanks to those floodwaters.
7:15 is the time. Here in Pennsylvania, the word unpredictable fails to capture quite the weirdness of the presidential race as we enter the final weekend. Nothing seems to shift it one way or the other. The stunts, the gaffes, the changes of candidate, the assassination attempts. Still, at the end of it all, they are tied in the polls. It is margin of error stuff. And this state, Pennsylvania, matters hugely because it's so popular. So it has a whacking 19 electoral college votes. They went to Biden last time, but to Trump in 2016. It is unlikely that the loser here can win the White House. Sean Trendy watches the polls for realclearpolitics.com and sees some cautiously good news for the Trump campaign.
Pennsylvania looks to be the state where Trump seems to be emerging with something of a lead in the polls. In the last few days, his lead in our average is almost up to a point. And so if he wins Pennsylvania, Harris has a really difficult time winning the Electoral College. So that's why I say it looks like there's some movement towards Trump in these closing days.
But still within the margin of error, presumably, all the polls that you're talking about and you put into your average.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I know it's I'm trying to play off of the it's trite to say it's close, to give a little bit of definition of what we're seeing, but it's close. I mean, that is honestly the ultimate bottom line here. This is an election that could easily go either way.
We tend to concentrate on the two main characters, but of course, there's a huge advertising campaign. You really feel that in the state of Pennsylvania if you turn on the television. And I think it's fair to say a lot of people are completely sick of it. But have the adverts worked? I'm thinking first perhaps about Kamala Harris's advertising, this relentless stuff about Donald Trump himself, but also the sense that she's trying to get across a kind of economic message that maybe separates her a bit from Joe Biden and the administration she's been a part of.
Donald Trump intends to give tax breaks to billionaires and big corporations. When I am president, I will bring down the cost of groceries. And unlike Donald Trump, I will always put the middle class and working families first.
Donald Trump has been national political figure here for a decade. Everyone has made up their mind one way or the other about Donald Trump. So emphasizing that he has all these very real problems, in my view, doesn't really, I think, change anyone's mind about him. I think what people wanted to know is Kamala Harris kind of sat in the background of the Biden administration for 4 years, and then all of a sudden she's a presidential nominee. I think people wanted to get a better sense of who she is. And that's something that's been lacking in her campaign.
And of course, pinning her to Joe Biden and to this administration has been a key part, hasn't it, of the Trump advertisements, and something they have done relentlessly, not just in Pennsylvania, but right throughout the nation.
Now Kamala wants to double down on failure. It's time to turn the page on Joe and Kamala's failed agenda. President Trump fights for you.
President Biden's job approval has been in the low 40s for a very long time. People are not happy with the job his administration's done, fairly or unfairly. And so it's almost a no-brainer for Donald Trump to say, look, she's vice president of this administration you don't like. And as I said, she may try to inch away for Joe Biden, but she has a tough time throwing him completely under the bus and saying, I'm going to do things very differently.
How much damage do you think he did to her, Biden did to Harris, with his gaffe about Trump supporters being garbage, which was something that he said in the last few days and which the Trump campaign has certainly made a lot of, with pictures of Donald Trump in a garbage truck and dressed as a garbage man and all the rest of it. I mean, is that just sort of a piece of nonsense that goes away? Do you think it does have a real impact?
Well, it had a couple things. First, whatever else you might say about Donald Trump, he's fun. Or he can be fun, I guess. He can poke fun at himself. He can do things that would make any other politician seem ridiculous, like dress up like a garbage man and get in a garbage truck. So I think it actually kind of paints Trump in a bit of a flattering light in the closing days. The more important thing, though, is that Harris's strategy and what they wanted to be talking about right now was Donald Trump's comedian at his Madison Square Garden rally, you know, making the comment that Puerto Rico was a floating pile of garbage. Instead, Joe Biden knocked them completely off message. And the main way it hurts is distracting from the message that Harris really wants to be talking about, which is not whether President Biden thinks half the country is a bunch of garbage.
In a way, the most extraordinary thing is the polls, they were pretty tied at the beginning of the summer, weren't they? They're pretty tied now.
So that's perhaps the most astonishing thing, that for all this, we're basically back to where we were in the polls before Joe Biden had his debate flop. The popular vote is close. The Sun Belt states look to be slipping away, but Harris is holding on to what we might think of as a Rust Belt firewall to keep it competitive. It's really astonishing.
Sean Trendy, pollster at Real Clear Politics. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
It's 20 past seven. Cutting sugar from a baby's diet, even when in the womb, cuts the risk of them suffering major diseases in later life. That's what scientists think we can learn from studying the impact of rationing in this country all those decades ago. Let's talk to Professor Steve Turner, President of the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health, about what he makes of that. Professor Turner, not your report. So what did you think of it when you read its findings?
Nick, good morning. I was terribly excited when I read these findings, and it just so happens this is an area of research interest that I share. So this just adds to a large body of evidence that could be summarised by saying, look after fetuses and look after children in their first 2 years of life. That's the 1,000 days between conception and our second birthday, because that lays down the track for our future health and well-being. And if we don't get it right then, it's really difficult to get us back on track.
Look after the baby in the womb, critically.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I was young, I went to medical school back in the 90s and was reassured that the baby inside of its mum's tum was in a privileged position. It could not be affected by the environment because the mother, the womb, and the placenta protected it. But we now know that that's a version of the truth that nobody believes. Babies, before they are born, are exposed to many, many environmental stimulants through either directly through the tissues of their mum, but also through mum's blood. So air pollution is harmful for babies. Obviously, smoking is bad for everybody. And there's a considerable and a robust literature that demonstrates that the fetus is very sensitive to what's happening around it. And this study that was done in people who were born in the early 50s is just another piece of the jigsaw that builds a picture up to say that, that before we are born, we are immensely sensitive to what's happening in our environment, and we need to be looked after at that early stage in our life.
Now, when we talk about cutting sugar, I think many people listening might think you mean obvious sources of sugar, things like chocolate, for example. Yeah. But there's all sorts of things that we regard as healthy, fruit drinks, vegetable drinks, which actually contain an awful lot of sugar.
Sure. So no, you're quite right. And it would be fair to say that the industry has marketed things very clearly. So you very carefully said fruit and then fruit drinks. So fruit is a really good source of sugar for us as human beings. That's what we've evolved to get our sugar from. Fruit juice, on the other hand, is not. Fruit juice not only is an adulterated form of what we should be eating, although it's quite nice, but it is topped up with sugar. So essentially, if it comes in a packet, it's not healthy. It's got added sugar and other such things that make it tasty but not good for us. The other adage is that if your grandmother doesn't recognize it, a baby's fruit pouch, for example, it's also probably not healthy.
It's as easy as that, is it, Professor Turner? You think anything in a packet has probably had to be preserved. It's probably been preserved with sugar, maybe salt as well, by the way, and therefore avoid it if you can.
Yeah, I mean, I do like to keep things simple, but I think as a generalism, it's probably not wrong.
Well, that's very clear advice. Thank you so much for that. Professor Steve Turner, the President of the Royal College of Paediatrics.
24 minutes past seven, as we were hearing earlier in the programme. It has been a turbulent week for UK gilts, government bonds, off the back of the Chancellor's budget. Felicity Hannah's back to tell us what has been happening and why.
Yes, so yields on 10-year UK gilts rose to their highest level in a year at 4.51%, meaning borrowing is costing the government more. Let's talk to Christian Kopf, who's from the Union Investment Group in Frankfurt and oversees trades in many different government bonds, including in UK gilts. Christian, good morning.
Good morning, Felicity.
Does this mean, then, that lenders like you are worried about the contents of the budget?
Not really. I think it was a very meager increase in yields. Yields rose by 0.1%, and yields and bond prices always move in opposite directions. So the increase in yields led to a slight decline in the price of bonds, but very little compared to previous shocks we've had in the UK gilt market.
Okay, so UK gilt yields, then, effectively the cost of borrowing to the UK government, are still quite a lot higher than US or German bonds. So why is that?
Well, they're just slightly higher than the US bonds. You have a yield of 4.4% in the UK on the 10-year gilt, and you have 4.3% on 10-year US government bonds. So the yield difference, which is a relatively small yield difference, is related to the differences in the base rate. The Bank of England has a 5.0% base rate, while the Federal Reserve in the US has already cut rates to 4.8%. So that explains the slight yield difference. And in the euro area, yields are lower in general. Growth is a bit lower in the euro area. Our base rate is 3.3%, and this is why the German Bund yields are also much lower.
There's some pretty brutal front pages for the Chancellor to digest this morning about the market's reaction to the budget. I mean, how does, you've talked about it being fairly meagre, how does it then compare to the fallout we saw following Liz Truss's mini budget, which has become pretty much a hallmark for an extremely unhappy bond market?
Yeah, that's correct. The situation in September 2022, after the release of Chancellor Kwarteng's mini-budget, was totally different. By orders of magnitude, it was 10 times bigger. At the time, we had a yield increase in the UK gilt market by 1%, and this time around, yields only rose by 0.1%. So at the time, what we had was a very irresponsible fiscal policy being presented to the electorate in that mini-budget, a plan to scrap the top tax rate to keep corporate taxes very low, to fund the biggest tax cut in UK history entirely by increased government borrowing. And that led to a situation where people said, not with me, I'm out. But, you know, this time around is very different.
You're clearly feeling fairly content with this, but we do have 10-year UK gilts at the highest level in a year at 4.51%. And over such massive sums of money, even a small incremental increase can obviously add a huge cost. Is this likely to be only a temporary reaction from the markets to a new government approach?
Yeah, I mean, 10-year UK gilt yields have been at the highest level in many years before the budget and at the highest level in many years after the budget. Budget hasn't changed anything in that respect. Yeah. And, you know, of course, borrowing rates are high, but that has mainly to do with the fact that the Bank of England has raised its policy rate a lot.
Christian Kopp from Union Investment Group in Frankfurt, thank you very much.
Phyllis, thank you. We'll be keeping an eye on those markets as they proceed over the next few hours. Meanwhile, with the sport, here's Mike.
Nick, thank you. It was meant to be a new chapter for England's white ball cricketers out in the Caribbean. They were looking to start afresh with a new look side after a pretty woeful last 12 months that's seen them meekly surrender two World Cups, the limited over side. But this new dawn did not get off to a great start. England convincingly beaten by the West Indies in Antigua overnight. Test match specials Daniel Norcross was watching the match and joins us now. Morning, Dan.
Good morning.
So they lost by 8 wickets, didn't they, and were, frankly, outplayed?
Well, they were completely shellacked, to be honest. They didn't get anything like enough runs. On what wasn't a blameless pitch, but it wasn't that awkward either. And then, well, West Indies cantered to victory by 8 wickets with so long to spare. I mean, a brilliant batting performance by Evan Lewis. He hit 8 sixes in his 94. But England were completely outclassed. And, you know, in mitigation, they had 4 debutants. They got a very young side. They're very inexperienced, but they've lost 12 out of 18 one-day internationals now. And the West Indies haven't even qualified for the Champions Trophy coming up in February, so they're not even really playing top-tier opposition here. It was a very disappointing performance.
12 out of 18 is a pretty damning stat, isn't it? And that feeds into a wider point, doesn't it, Dan, about the amount of 50-over cricket being played by English players currently?
Well, they don't really play it at all because the 50-over competition, the domestic one in England, takes place at the same time as the 100, which is a much remarked-on event. And so young players like, you know, Jacob Bethell, yesterday Jordan Cox, who was making his debut, he's 24 years old. He's only played 50-over cricket 4 times in his life. Now, that's really unsustainable. You look at the sort of sides that England are playing against. They're playing against very experienced professionals, and England's younger players just don't get the opportunity to play the game at all.
Dan Norcross, many thanks. Quick turnaround for England. The second ODI is back in Antigua on Saturday, tomorrow, with the final deciding match in Barbados next week. Briefly away from the cricket, in tennis, British number one Jack Draper out of the Paris Masters. He was beaten in the third round yesterday by the Australian ninth seed Alex de Minaur. The defeat also ends the 22-year-old's faint chances of sneaking into the season-ending ATP finals. Carlos Alcaraz also out of the Paris Masters yesterday. And just a preview of the next hour. It's the 1st of November, of course, and you know winter is well and truly on the way when the FA Cup first round rolls around, and that begins this evening. There are 32 non-league sides still left in the competition, and we will speak to the manager of one of those plucky sides in the next hour of the programme.
Mike, thank you. Let us look ahead right now, though, to tonight's 6:30 comedy.
How do I sum up Dead Ringers in a few words?
It feels so fresh.
Biting, topical, satire.
With some of the best impressionists in the UK.
Who can we hear in the new series? Well, that's very much developing.
It really is very, very topical.
Rachel Reeves seems to have caught this cold that's always going around the Labour Party.
Lee Anderson talking about ridiculous wokeness and all that sort of stuff.
Sometimes Giles Brandreth will swoop in with a flourish, puffing up the upholstery of the sketch.
The new series of Dead Ringers, Friday night 6:30 comedy on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, which is a proper belting app.
A quick look at the weather now. If you've not listened to Dead Rees, you really must. It's brilliant. Mostly dry in the south. Some light rain possible in the southeast. It'll be cloudy with a few spots of light rain or drizzle across northern England and Scotland.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4. Nick Robinson in London, Justin Webb in Philadelphia, and at 29 minutes to 8, Jane Steele with the news.
Spanish rescue and response teams have been searching for the dozens of people still missing after this week's flash floods in the Valencia region. At least 158 people are known to have died. Hundreds of troops have been deployed to help with the rescue efforts. There are accusations that the civil protection agencies weren't as prepared as they could have been. GPs, care homes and hospices have raised concerns that they will have to pay the higher employer national insurance contributions announced in the budget. They're not covered by the exemption for the public sector. Hospices argue that those providing NHS services should be treated the same as NHS bodies. The Department of Health and Social Care said details on how the change would affect GPs would be announced in due course. The Democratic and Republican presidential candidates have been campaigning in the battleground states of Nevada and Arizona before the election next Tuesday. Kamala Harris has been focusing on reproductive rights and has criticised her rival for his remarks about women. Donald Trump has been reiterating his 2020 allegations about voter fraud. BBC News has found that a victim reported alleged sexual abuse by the former Harrods owner Mohammed Al-Fayed to the Metropolitan Police a decade earlier than has recently been acknowledged. Samantha Ramsey made the allegations to the force in 1995. Until now, the Met has said its first report dated from 2005. The force says there's no history of Samantha Ramsey's case on its computer systems, but that paper-based reports from the 1990s might not have been digitised. Researchers say cutting sugar in a child's first 1,000 days from conception to age 2 appears to reduce their risk of developing chronic diseases later into life. The study by the University of Southern California analysed the impact of ending sugar rationing in the UK after the Second World War. Those who'd consumed less sugar as young children had a 35% lower risk of developing type 2 diabetes and were 20% less likely to have high blood pressure.
Jane, thank you. 27 minutes to 8 is the time. I'm in Pennsylvania this morning, where there is a decent chance that everything will be decided next Tuesday or in the days after Tuesday. It is the most populous of the swing states. The polls show it tied, although we were hearing a few moments ago that Donald Trump might have some reason to be more confident of winning here than Kamala Harris. I've been talking to two men based here about their sense of how it is all looking now that the end of the campaign is nigh. Cliff Maloney is leading a multi-million dollar effort. It's called Pennsylvania Chase to get more Republicans to vote in the state. And Councilman Isaiah Thomas is Democratic Party councillor on Philadelphia City Council and chair of Black Men for Kamala Harris in Pennsylvania. I began with him, with Councilman Thomas, and whether the Democrats will persuade enough of their supporters to come out to vote on Tuesday.
Of course, we can get our people out on voting day. We're very optimistic that the city of Philadelphia is going to turn out in high numbers, as well as our surrounding suburbs. We've seen it in 2020. We've seen it in 2022. Why would 2024 be any different?
What works for you, Cliff? What has worked for you when you've been going out in this city in particular and talking to people, possibly former Democratic Party voters? What's worked?
Well, I think this is the first cycle, at least since Donald Trump's been around, that turning out Republican voters is enough to win. Right. I'll give Clinton, I'll give Biden the credit that back when they were running, Democrats were able to just turn out their voters. And so I think right now, as you're seeing, the issues that have drawn a lot of people to the Republican Party, being the border crisis, being fentanyl. I mean, a lot of these counties, especially surrounding the cities, they've been hit pretty hard with that stuff. I think you just look at the inflation in terms of what was life like 4 years ago compared to today. Voters are moving in that direction. They're comparing a Biden administration to a Trump administration, and I don't think they want it.
Councilman Thomas?
So I'll say a couple of things. It's always interesting when people say 4 years ago and talk about the economy because they just forget about COVID. 2020 was the worst economy that we've seen in the history of this country, and at the end of the day, we've seen leadership in Washington, D.C., that did probably the worst job that we've seen in over 100 years. So I know that we hear a lot of these issues. I'm listening to immigration come up more on the internet and in interviews than I've ever heard in the history of my life. I don't know what city or state people are living in, but Philadelphia doesn't have issues related to immigration, right? And it's important that people respect the intellect of the voters here in the city of Philadelphia and our surrounding areas.
Is there a problem with your candidate, with Donald Trump himself, or is he a net plus in this place, in Philadelphia?
I think he's an absolute net plus. I think the guy, you know, represents what a lot of people want, which is somebody that represents the blue collar, the working class. I think there is a huge political shift going on right now, unlike we've ever, probably since Obama. When Obama came onto the scene, I give him credit. It was a huge political shift. It's very tough to move voters, and he was able to do that and create this huge coalition for Democrats. I think when Trump came around, now that he is the working class candidate, I have a lot of lifelong Democrats in my family who are now supporting Trump because they feel as if the party has moved to more the elites, the coastals, and the folks that are focused on helping those in D.C., not us here in our community.
Where do you want me to start at? I mean, the idea that Donald Trump represents the working class is insane. That's crazy. That's crazy. Not only is this guy somebody who has never been a working class person for one single day in his life, all of the major unions who represent working class people, not just in the city of Philadelphia, but across this country, are adamantly opposed to him. Now, is Kamala Harris a candidate who represents working class people? Absolutely, because if you look at not just the people who support her, but her position on the issues, are the things that best benefit working class people. That's why the majority of your unions are with her.
Cliff Mullaney, does the fact that Donald Trump tried to overthrow a Democratic election not mean that at least for some of your supporters, and I suppose I'm thinking in particular of moderate Republicans, as it were, people who have been toying with the idea of voting for him, that simple fact, when they're reminded of it, puts them off voting for him?
Not at all. I think there are much bigger problems. I think people can look at January 6th and see that Democrats are using it consistently. They keep going back to it, right? If people want to address it, it's been addressed. We're
but
moving
it happened.
Forward.
And he's sticking to it. That's the point, isn't it?
We're focused on 2024 and what's in store in 2025. And so I think a lot of people, this is what they're jumping to on the left, because they don't have things that they can point to under a Biden administration that they can say, hey, listen, these are the things that are something we're excited about. And so, no, I think Republicans are focused on the future. Republicans are looking for solutions. And I think that to try to assert that we are not the party of blue collar, when you see Republicans gaining with black men, you see Republicans gaining with Hispanic men, you see Republicans gaining with working class across the board, the issues are connecting. And so I just think that this is going to be a coalition shift. What is the Democrat base coalition after this? If they lose on Tuesday, I really don't know who they're going to turn to build a coalition that can win nationally.
Can I just bring it down to this city? Because this city is so important. This state is hugely important, because whoever wins this state is probably going to win the election. Who wins this city? There's no doubt about that. Harris will win. But it's the amount she wins by, isn't it? And is it not right, Councilman, that there is a segment of particularly the black young male vote, and perhaps Hispanic young males as well, that has been pulled away from her successfully by Donald Trump?
No, emphatically no. And I think that the idea that we're going to continue this dialogue, that black men have been pulled away for Kamala Harris, as if black men are not going to be the second largest voting demographic for Kamala Harris on Tuesday, is something that's not only absurd, but it's disrespectful to black men.
No, but not as large as it has been. That's the point that people are making.
How do you know? You saw the future?
No, I've seen the polls.
So polls, what do polls mean? Polls told us that Donald Trump was going to lose, and he won. The polls aren't necessarily accurate. Listen, I'm on the ground talking to black men every single day. I live in the city. I'm born and raised in the city. I still coach high school basketball. When I'm done this conversation, I'm going to spend my time with a lot of young black men, and I do that on a consistent basis. I haven't met one black man that says, I'm voting for Donald Trump. Now, have we met a lot of young black men who've said, I don't plan on voting? Absolutely. That's a real problem we have, and we've been trying to move the needle as it relates to that particular issue. But the idea that mass media and media keeps pushing that black men are not with Kamala Harris and black men in record numbers are going to vote for Donald Trump is inaccurate. It doesn't make sense, and it's not reflective of what we're seeing on the ground on a consistent basis.
Final thought. In this state, voting is going to be slower than it could be. And that could be a problem, not just for this state, but for the nation more generally.
My wish, because I do want it to be a very smooth night where we all agree on the winner and everybody's confident, okay? I really hope that the amount of whoever, Harris or Trump, whoever wins, I hope they win by a strong enough amount that any of the outstanding provisionals, any of the military ballots, I hope it doesn't cover the difference. Both for Republicans' sake and for Democrats' sake. I'd like to see a clean win on election night.
Councilman Thomas?
I wish that all Republicans had that exact same sentiment as it relates to the outcome of the election. I agree with them 100%. I do hope it's a large enough margin that we're not coming down to the final provisional ballots and absentee ballots and things of that capacity. And I'm hoping that the people of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania chooses democracy over dictatorship.
Councilman Thomas, Cliff Mullaney as well. Thank you both.
Thank you all.
Thank you for having me.
Now 19 minutes to 8. If there are alien life forms living beyond our solar system, how would we tell them about us? Well, we might play them the sounds of life on Earth.
Deep down in Louisiana, close to New Orleans.
doesn't put a smile on the aliens' faces, I don't know what will. Those are the sounds and the music that alien life forms will hear if they stumble across Voyager 1, the spacecraft whose mission, since its launch almost 50 years ago when those sounds and music were recorded, was to leave our solar system and go as far from Earth as possible, sending back messages about what the spacecraft came across. Just one problem, though. NASA occasionally loses touch with Voyager 1 as it gets further and further from the Earth. But this week, NASA scientists were celebrating when, after days of radio silence, the spacecraft called home again using a bit of kit that has been sleeping for many decades. We're joined, I'm delighted to say, by Professor Gary Hunt, one of the original Voyager team from back in the 70s. Morning to you, Professor Hunt.
Good morning.
We'll talk about what happened this week in a second, but great joy hearing those music. There must have been quite a debate about what exactly we should play those alien life forms.
Glad you played Chuck Berry, because I can remember being with Chuck at the great celebration when we got past Neptune. And I always say, you're no Voyagers coming, you're here, Chuck Berry.
Yes, you didn't personally go past Neptune.
Thank you very much for playing.
Now tell us the story of this week, because suddenly there's silence, and that happens the further Voyager 1 gets from Earth, and then it woke up again. What happened?
Well, it's really been awake. It's just a question of finding it. And the thing was, it's out in distant space. It's pretty cold out there, as you can imagine. We are 24 billion kilometres away. And, you know, if we were having this conversation now and I was on Voyager, you would send your message now. I would hear it on Saturday and reply on Sunday, which would mean you'll change the name of your programme for a start. I think the key thing was that they sent out a command, please put on the heaters. We've got to warm up a little bit. And this was sent out on the 16th of October. Nothing came back by the 18th. It takes 23 hours to get the message out and 23 hours back. And then everybody said, goodness God, what earth has happened? And the engineers, these are the clever people. Scientists, we get all the credit, but they are the clever people, are the engineers. They looked around and they thought, well, something must be causing this problem. And what had happened was the command sent up had triggered what we call the fault protection system. Voyager is an example of how to do spacecraft engineering, which I hope the modern commercial people would take into account. It checks to make sure everything is working correctly. The triggering of setup, it moved around and it triggered twice and changed the signal from coming up on one channel, the main channel, which is what we call X-band, mm-hmm. and to another channel. Yeah. And unfortunately, the other channel it moved to is a very weak one and one they weren't expecting.
Yeah, but the bit of kit that rescued it hadn't been used for decades and sort of sprung into life.
Well, indeed, this is the whole secret. Voyager had every backup you can imagine, was prepared for anything. Yes, and it switches. And if it cannot record on one channel, it flips to another one. Mm. We do the same on our radios and various other techniques. And the trouble was, that was something we weren't expecting. And the engineers quite correctly said, gosh, this is such a weak signal. We don't normally track that one. And yes, they found it still alive, still working. And now they're trying to get the spacecraft back to communicating correctly on the channel they always.
Well, it's a great tribute to you, the scientists, the engineers who worked on that original project, dating back originally, way back to 1972, a few years before it was launched. So thank you for telling us about it. The only Brit who worked on the Voyager space mission, Professor Gary Hunt, thank you.
It is just coming up to 8:15. And coming up in a few minutes, as the dust starts to settle after Wednesday's budget, so we are very much back down to earth, we're going to take a closer look at what the rise in employer national insurance payments will mean for care homes and for GPs.
Now, we've been asking all week for your suggestions of spooky Halloween-themed books you've delivered as always. This morning's recommendation is Stephen Mitchell's The Tinderbox. Whilst not associated with Halloween, the suspenseful story and scary illustrations combine to create the perfect page-turning read.
Good morning. Amanda in Exeter here. I've loved hearing the spooky-themed Children's Book Club recommendations this week and wanted to share Stephen Mitchell's 2007 retelling of Hans Christian Andersen's The Tinderbox with listeners.
Whilst not traditionally associated with this time of year, the suspenseful story and intricately scary illustrations by Bagram Ibutalin combine to create the perfect mix of page-turning trepidation and frightful frisson, which still sends shivers down my teenage daughter's spine over 10 years later. This moral tale begins with a soldier returning from what his uniform suggests as being the Napoleonic Wars. He meets a witch who helps him climb down into the hollow of a tree, where he meets three dogs, each more frightening and with saucer-like eyes larger than the last. Each vicious-looking creature sits on a chest of coins of increasing value to which the soldier can help himself, on the condition that he brings back an inconspicuous-looking tinderbox for the witch. I will leave you wondering how this story ends, which I highly recommend for lovers of beautiful, illustrated books of all ages.
Lots to recommend. And if you've got a recommendation, WhatsApp us 0330 123 4346. It's time now at 12 minutes to 8 for Thought for the Day. And joining us in the studio this morning is the writer, Rydyn Brookman. Good morning, Rydyn.
Good morning. 100 years ago, an Englishwoman called Eglantine Jebb said that every war is a war against children. In 1919, she founded Save the Children, a relief to relieve the effects of war and the starving children of Austria, Britain's former enemy. She would go on to draft the Declaration of Rights of the Child that would form the basis of the UN Charter, rights that 198 countries have now agreed to, and that include a child's right to play, an education, access to health services, and safety from violence. The rights she helped define are being severely tested by the current conflict in Israel and Gaza, where, according to the UN estimates, 14,000 children have been killed since the Hamas attack on Israel just over a year ago. Meanwhile, for the children still living, there are no safe spaces, no easy access to water, food or medicine, and the trauma of loss is ever present. Many have cried, "Get the children out," whilst watching this conflict. It was this same sentiment that once motivated British families to establish the Kinder Transport. "Get the children out" was also the cry that saw the evacuation of 800,000 British children from cities during the Blitz, a campaign that killed over 43,000 people. Truth may be the first casualty of war, but it is children who take the first hit. As the head of UNICEF said, children don't start wars and have no power to end wars, but they suffer the most. And it is a fact that more children have died in this war than soldiers. If only there was some kind of Kinder Transport for the children of Gaza, or a genuine evacuation plan to get them out of harm's way. The end of Genesis 4 describes an explosion of violence that starts with Cain killing his brother and ends with Lamech's terrifying intent to escalate and avenge an offence done to him. "I have slain a man for wounding me," says Lamech. "If Cain is avenged sevenfold, then I will be avenged 77-fold." In this he established a universal pattern of violence, a hell's arithmetic that still seems to be playing out today. Scripture says that whoever welcomes a child welcomes God. Wanting to save the lives of children is not about taking sides. It is simply a humane imperative and a God-given instruction. If it is offensive to suggest this, then that is nothing compared to the offence war causes to the minds and bodies of children. So, while nations argue about this conflict, about who started it, and the right conditions for a ceasefire, can we please think about the children caught up in war and find a way to get them out of it?
And that was Thought for the Day with Rydyn Brook. It brings us to 9 minutes to 8.
If it's a choice of whether workers or businesses pay the price to fund the NHS, I'd prefer it to be businesses. That was the Chancellor's justification for a big budget tax hike, the increase in employers' national insurance. But amongst those employers counting the costs are GPs and the owners of care homes, who are now having to assess what it'll mean for their ability to pay their staff and indeed to hire new ones. Speaking on Question Time last night, the Chief Secretary of the Treasury, Darren Jones, was asked about the issue.
GP surgeries are privately owned partnerships. Yep. They're not part of the public sector. They will therefore have to pay them, but how much they pay will depend on the size.
But it won't be going back into the NHS, it'll be going to the Treasury.
Well, it will come to the Treasury as taxes always do. But of course, we've made the commitment to put money directly into the NHS, so it will flow through, yes.
So GPs will pay the national insurance. Paul Stanley is a practice manager at Gashouse Lane, which is a small, semi-rural doctor's practice in Northumberland.
I've done some very quick sums earlier on this morning, and it looks like for a practice of our size with our number of staff, it's going to cost us something in the region of £40,000 a year. It is a huge amount of money, and our staff costs do equate to, I would probably say, about 65-70% of all of the costs of the practice. I think what we're looking at is an unfunded increase in our staffing costs, which may ultimately impact on our resources and our staffing levels. The increased costs might mean that we have to think about the levels of staffing that we actually have.
Well, joining us on the line is another GP, GP from Shropshire, Dr. Jess Harvey, and also Jeff Butcher, who's owner, chief executive of family care business, Blackadder Corporation, which has got six care homes across the Midlands. Morning to you both.
Morning.
Let's start with the sums, can we, first of all? Dr. Harvey, have you yet done the sums to work out what it'll mean for your practice, this increase in national insurance contributions?
Listen, in honesty, no, I haven't. But then hearing my colleague there talking about their sums, I'm kind of glad that I've managed to put that off. I think there's something that I think would help for people to understand in terms of the way that general practice is funded, is that I heard the Newsnight clip, and yes, we are classed as private businesses, but the money that we get to run that business isn't generated by profit, as I'm sure you can imagine, in terms of we aren't charging people for a service. The government give us a specific amount to run our general practice, which is based on the number of patients we have. The amount of money that we are getting in at the moment is the same as we were getting in 2018. And I'm sure if any of your listeners think about how their household bills have changed since 2018, their shopping, their utility bills, we're in exactly the same position as GPs in terms of running our practices. Our staffing costs have gone up and up each year, rightly so, due to the rate of inflation and the cost of living crisis. And I'm glad that we've been able to give our staff those rises. But the amount that we're getting given from the government hasn't changed.
But there may be business owners all over the country going, well, hold on, we're going to have to take a hit. We're going to have to make our contribution to dealing with the problems in the public sector. GPs earning on average more than 100,000 a year. 109,000, I think, is the average now. Maybe you just have to take a bit of a hit.
It's not. I'm pragmatic about this, but on a personal level, in terms of, you know, is trying to get this country back up and running after so many years of neglect. However, how general practice is funded, and this isn't about GPs, this isn't about my wage. I don't want an increase in my wage. What I want to be able to do is to provide the same service that I'm providing now, if not better, in the future. And during these contract negotiations for our new contract, unless we're getting given suitable remuneration to cover this national insurance inflation, then we're going to really struggle. There are going to be practices that are going to have to make redundancies. Mm. There are practices that are already considering redundancies because it's so hard to manage financially. And if we don't get enough money to continue to run these practices, then we're not going to be able to provide the service that people want.
Thank you, Dr. Harvey. Let's turn to Jeff Butcher, who runs that family care home business. Morning to you again. Have you calculated what it'll mean for you?
I have, Nick, yeah. £200,000 a year, on top of a £500,000 increase in the national minimum wage, which I'm delighted for because our staff have been under-remunerated for so long. But we're faced with an unfunded increase of costs around about £700,000 a year.
So £700,000 for a business with a profit of what sort of level?
This will represent a cut of 50% of our free cash, Nick, is probably the way to say it. Yeah. So we will now be in breach of our banking covenants. So that's another way of doing it, because we have to borrow money to buy care homes and invest in them and what have you. So, yeah, it is absolutely fundamental.
And it means you'll do what in terms of trying to make the budget add up?
We will certainly not be taking on additional staff. We will be having to cut back on improvement. So this morning I was supposed to be going to a home to look at investing in a small extension and a new passenger lift. That almost certainly will have to go. And I know that colleagues in other services are looking at cutting back on staffing, and I think it'll exacerbate the speed of closure of homes and the handing back of contracts by other services, including domiciliary care.
There is more money in the budget for local councils for adult and children's social care. Will that not cover your costs? And can't you, the same point to you that I put to Dr. Harvey, take a bit of a hit, contribute your share?
Let me address both points. The $600 million that has been allocated to social care, if it came through, which is very unlikely, that would represent £350 per employee in the social care service sector.
And just a few seconds, if you would, to address the other point.
Okay. The other point is staff costs are 80% of our total costs. We've got nowhere to go on this, Nick. And I find it extraordinary that year after year, governments find billions to support the likes of Ukraine, but we don't find the money to support our very vulnerable people. I think it's a huge reflection on our society.
Jeff Butcher of the Blackadder Corporation, Dr. Jess Harvey, thank you.
Thank you very much for that, Nick. Let us turn, we wonder if it might come up as a subject, I suppose, to Alex Forsyth, who is joining us to tell us about what's happening on Any Questions Tonight. Morning, Alex.
Good morning. Tonight we are in Flackwell Heath, the village on the outskirts of High Wycombe in Buckinghamshire. And now the fine print of the budget's been picked over, we have a panel to take stock. James Murray is the Exchequer Secretary to the Treasury and stood alongside the Chancellor in Downing Street this week. John Glenn is the Shadow Paymaster General and spent several years as a Treasury Minister when his party was in power. Daisy Cooper is the Liberal Democrats' Treasury spokesperson. And we have Paul Johnson of the Institute for Fiscal Studies to separate the fiscal fact from fiction. We will be live at 8 p.m. here on Radio 4.
With the weather now, Sarah Keith Lucas.
Thanks, Nick. Well, we've got high pressure still holding on for most of us, so a lot of dry weather on the cards, not just today, but the next few days as well. Some rain with a weak front sitting across the north of Scotland. So if you are across the northern half of Scotland, a bit of a damp start to the day here. That rain will tend to fizzle out as it moves its way south. So a little bit of light rain and drizzle into the central belt. Parts of southeast Scotland, even the northeast of England, seeing a little bit of that drizzle later in the day. But to the north of that, a return to some sunnier skies later. But for the rest of the UK, away from Scotland and northeast England, it is looking dry. We've got a lot of cloud. There'll just be a few glimpses of blue sky breaking through that cloud at times. And for most of us, still very mild. So temperatures this afternoon between about 14 to 16 degrees, a touch colder across the north of Scotland with that cooler but brighter air moving in, only 8 or 9 degrees here. And then high pressure keeps things largely dry and settled through the weekend too. Still pretty cloudy and grey on Saturday, but more sunshine in the forecast by Sunday.
Sarah, thank you for that. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson in London, Justin Webb in Philadelphia.
Good morning from London and from Philadelphia. It is 8 o'clock on Friday, the 1st of November. The headlines this morning. Officials in Spain say floods have caused loss of life on a horrifying scale. Dozens of people are still missing. GP surgeries, care homes and hospices say they're likely to be hit hard by tax rises for employers announced in the budget. I'll be talking to the Chief Secretary of the Treasury in the coming half hour. And BBC News has learned that sexual assault allegations against Mohammed Al-Fayed were made to the police 10 years earlier than the forces admitted.
Also in the programme, the road to the White House for Kamala Harris or Donald Trump has to go through Pennsylvania, where I am this morning. I've been hearing about an election campaign which has frazzled minds and divided families.
Do you ever talk about politics?
No, we don't. Really.
No, we don't. We try not to talk about politics.
My definition of what it is not his definition. So it's his prerogative who he votes for. It's my prerogative who I vote for.
And this moment.
That's what girls have to think about all the time.
Yeah.
Am I right, ladies?
That was when the actress Saoirse Ronan silenced the men on the Graham Norton sofa. We will discuss how women think about keeping themselves safe on the street. The BBC News read this morning by Jane Steele.
Emergency teams in Spain have been combing through stranded cars and abandoned buildings for some of the dozens and dozens of people officials say are still missing after catastrophic flooding in the eastern Valencia region. At least 158 people are known to have died, though it's feared that number will rise. The regional government has announced more than $200 million worth of aid for those affected, but there are accusations that civil protection agencies weren't fully prepared. From the city of Valencia, Bethany Bell sent this report.
Rescue teams are still searching for missing people. Spain's Minister of Territorial Policy, Ángel Víctor Torres, said it was impossible to confirm how many were still unaccounted for. But he said the data was already absolutely horrifying. With every day, he said, the hopes of finding them alive diminish. Survivors have told us how they felt abandoned by the authorities. In a suburb of Valencia where the streets are caked with mud and debris, we met José Ramón. We don't see the army, he said. We don't see civil defence. We don't see machines cleaning. Solidarity doesn't exist. There are fears that some of these scenes could be repeated further south. In the city of Jerez, hundreds of families have been evacuated from their homes as heavy rain raises river levels.
GPs, care homes and hospices have voiced concerns that they will have to pay the higher employer national insurance contributions announced in the budget. They're not covered by the exemption for the public sector, as our political correspondent Harry Farley reports.
The NHS was at the heart of Labour's first budget, and as part of the public sector, it will not have to pay the extra employer national insurance contributions. But other healthcare providers will. That will hit care homes and hospices particularly hard, with Hospice UK arguing those providing NHS services should be treated the same as NHS bodies. There is also confusion over the impact on GP surgeries, many of which are run as small businesses. Last night, the Department of Health and Social Care said further details would be announced in due course. Officials added they would work to ensure appropriate compensation for the public sector. But the Chief Secretary to the Treasury, Darren Jones, told Question Time GPs would have to pay the hike in employer national insurance. That, said GPs, would have a monumental impact on surgeries across the country.
The man appointed by the Chancellor to advise the government on saving money will earn about £50,000 a year for working one day a week. The Treasury says David Goldston, the independent chair of the new Office for Value for Money, will be paid a day rate of £950. BBC News has found that the Metropolitan Police was told about allegations of sexual abuse by the former Harrods owner Mohamed Al-Fayed a decade earlier than Scotland Yard has recently acknowledged. A teenage girl reported him to the force in 1995. Until now, the Met has said its first report dated from 2005. Al-Fayed died last year and was never charged with any sexual offences. Daniel DeSimone reports.
Samantha Ramsey was 17 when she reported Mohamed Al-Fayed to the Met in 1995 for sexually assaulting her in Harrods. She has since died, but her family say the Met dismissed her report. They believe multiple women could have been saved from sexual abuse if the force had acted. Since a BBC film in September exposed rape and abuse by Al-Fayed, the Met has accepted that 21 women reported him from 2005 until his death. But Samantha's report was a decade before, meaning the Met knew about him much earlier. The force says there's no history of Samantha's case on its computer systems, but that paper-based reports from the 1990s might not have been digitised.
With just 4 days to go to the US presidential election, Donald Trump and Kamala Harris have been campaigning in the battleground states of Arizona and Nevada. The vice president has put the issue of abortion at the centre of her pitch to voters, framing the election as a fight for women's freedom. At a rally in Las Vegas, Ms. Harris was endorsed by the singer Jennifer Lopez, who appeared on stage with her and addressed the crowd.
I promised myself I wouldn't get emotional, but you know what? We should be emotional. Yeah. We should be upset. We should be scared and outraged. Our pain matters. We matter.
Mr. Trump took aim at the Democrats' climate policy at one of his rallies in Nevada. He suggested the party wanted to ban cows and windows in buildings. Israeli warplanes have bombed Beirut's southern suburbs for the first time in days. Yesterday, 7 people, including 4 Thai farm workers, were killed by Hezbollah rocket fire on Israel, and 6 health workers were killed by Israeli attacks in southern Lebanon. Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, has met 2 US envoys trying to broker a deal to end the fighting. Around 1,800 former prisoners serving indefinite sentences will have their licence period ended today, meaning they no longer have to be supervised by the probation service. They were given imprisonment for public protection sentences, which meant they could be subject to supervision for their whole lives, which have since been abolished. Here's our senior UK correspondent, Seema Kotecha.
As of today, IPP offenders who were released from jail at least 5 years ago but not sent back to prison in the last 2 years will have their licences automatically terminated. That means they will no longer have to be monitored and abide by certain conditions. It used to be the case that people serving indefinite sentences had to wait at least 10 years after their release for the parole board to consider terminating their licence conditions. New IPP sentences were abolished in 2012. But there are still nearly 3,000 people in prison serving them, meaning they don't know when their time in custody will end.
A children's charity has claimed that nearly half of all online grooming offences recorded by police involve the messaging app Snapchat. The NSPCC said in total more offences were being committed than ever before. Our senior technology reporter Chris Vallance has more.
In the last year, there were a record 7,062 offences of sexual communication with a child in the UK, the NSPCC found. The charity said that in the 1,800 grooming cases where police recorded the means of communication, 48% mentioned Snapchat, more than WhatsApp, Facebook and Instagram combined. Snapchat, which has a high proportion of younger users, told the BBC it had zero tolerance for sexual exploitation and had extra safety measures for teenagers and their parents.
Researchers say cutting sugar in a child's first 1,000 days from conception to age 2 appears to reduce their risk of major diseases later in life. The study by the University of Southern California analysed the impact of ending sugar rationing in the UK after the Second World War. Professor Steve Turner, who's president of the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health, told us the early years of life were key in determining a person's health.
But this just adds to a large body of evidence that could be summarised by saying look after fetuses and look after children in their first 2 years of life. That's the 1,000 days between conception and our second birthday, because that lays down the track for our future health and well-being. And if we don't get it right then, it's really difficult to get us back on track.
A noun whose first known use dates back to the early 1500s has been named by the Collins Dictionary as its word of the year. Brat has been given the accolade for the way it's been adapted and then adopted during 2024. And as our culture reporter Annabel Rackham explains, that popularity has been attributed to one performer.
Here we go.
The singer Charlie XCX is widely seen as the inspiration behind Brat's cultural takeoff. I'm a brat when I'm bumping that. She used the word as the name of her chart-topping 6th studio album, which came out in June, inspiring a movement on social media. I'm your favorite reference, baby. It was redefined as someone who is confident, independent, and has a hedonistic attitude. Yeah, 360, when you're in the mirror, do you know what you see? Its use marked a departure from the preceding clean girl trend. The promoted things such as yoga and early nights on platforms such as TikTok. Brat was something even the US presidential candidate Kamala Harris got behind. After the pop star posted on X that Kamala is Brat, the Democrat hopeful rebranded her online campaign to mirror the album artwork. Other words that made it onto Collins' list this year included era, inspired by another pop star, Taylor Swift, and her sellout Eras Tour, and delulu, meaning utterly mistaken or unrealistic in one's ideas or expectations.
Annabel Rackham reporting.
Thank you, Jane. 8:10 is the time. Donald Trump dressing as a bin man and climbing onto a garbage truck to embrace the fact that Joe Biden seemed to call his supporters garbage. Kamala Harris campaigning with Jennifer Lopez, who promises a Hollywood ending, the good girl wins. All the stops being pulled out in the last moments of America's epic presidential election. And the focus in this final weekend on the swing states, where a few tens of thousands of votes could settle the whole thing. I'm in Pennsylvania, where the rural parts will vote heavily for Donald Trump. But the biggest city, Philadelphia, has traditionally been the place that has provided the blowout Democratic support that has tipped it towards them. Philadelphia, home of the Liberty Bell and the cheesesteak.
Cheese without onions, right here. Can we have pepper cheese work?
We're outside Pat's King of Steaks. There's a fantastic neon sign, and there's another sign telling us the history of this place. They originated here in 1930, it said. Invented the prototype of beefsteak sandwiches that uses an Italian-style roll and seasonings. It's been going since then, and there is a big crowd already for lunch. Just to give you a sense of what they are selecting for their lunch, one of them called the Originator, but another called the Heart Attack.
Pepper, cheese and onions.
If you come to Philadelphia, what do you do? You see the Statue of Liberty, you see the Rocky statue, you come to Pat's
Steak. What Statue of Liberty?
The other thing.
The Liberty Bell.
I am Frank Enrico Oliveri. I am the fourth generation owner of the world famous Pat's King of Steaks in South Philadelphia. Donald was here. Former President Donald Trump was here. We got the word that he was coming the day before, and there was really nothing we could do to stop him.
I talk well because my mother's a Trumpster.
She's delusional.
Don't even get it.
Don't even let me say it.
We look over politics.
We don't have a choice.
We're choiceless.
We don't have a choice.
Do you ever talk about politics?
No, we don't. Really.
No, we don't. We try not to talk about politics.
My definition of what it is not his definition. So it's his prerogative who he votes for. It's my prerogative who I vote for. Our definition of what's going on in the United States is totally, we have different interests.
See ya.
Bye. Bye-bye.
So no need to ask who you vote for.
What you just witnessed is a person who rejects reality and substitutes her own.
Is that your characterization as well of all Trump voters or a significant number of Trump voters?
I think that a lot of people who are cult-like following Trump are disillusioned in a lot of different ways.
We're here on this street with people, ordinary people walking past in a part of town where there isn't a lot of money. Do you hear from your own customers?
Customers are concerned about the prices of things. Do you think that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are responsible for higher grocery prices and oil prices? Or do you think that Donald Trump's responsible for those higher prices? Or do you think the previous administration to that's responsible? Yeah, you know what? They all are. We are in the kitchen, which is probably about 650 square feet. I don't know what that is in meters, because we don't learn the metric system here, because, you know, we're on this side of the pond.
And it's all stainless steel, and there's a lot going on. It's busy. Tell me about costs.
The meat's gone up probably like 25 to 35% since the pandemic. When our rolls have gone up maybe 35%, 40%.
And what's that done to the prices you charge people?
Well, we have to pass the prices along to our customers now.
But it's those extra costs that are hurting Kamala Harris, isn't it? Because they associate the inflation with this administration, and she's a part of the administration.
Yeah, she's a part of the administration, absolutely. And everybody associates what's wrong with the current administration and totally forgets about what the previous administration did to cause what's going on in this administration.
Righty, hey, we come out from the kitchen, out to the red benches, very basic red benches outside the restaurant. And let's talk to some diners. Ladies, can I bother you for a second? We're from the BBC in London.
Welcome.
We're talking to people about the election, not necessarily who you're voting for, but what you think the issues are. You can tell us.
We are from Boston,
right?
Here volunteering for the Harris campaign for the next week. So we're excited. We start the door knocking and phone calls and whatever they want us to do tomorrow through Election Day.
Looking at the streets around here where people are living pretty lives that are kind of paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah.
What are the issues they bring up with you?
The economy. It has to be. It's number one. I do know every time we talk, or I've talked to a Trump supporter, they say it's immigration. So when you're looking around, you see these diverse neighborhoods, it's always shocking that people are voting, and I'm going to just say it, voting for Trump, when in fact it's going to probably affect them more than anybody else.
Ladies, I'll let you get on with your steak. Thank you.
Thank you.
You got a view that you'll share with us?
Very simple. I hate the professional political class in this country. They don't have any real-world experience. The only thing they care about is getting elected, being getting re-elected, amassing power, maintaining that power, and getting elected again.
So if you believe those things, who do you vote for?
I vote for Trump, because he's coming from the real world.
Here's the thing about Pennsylvania. No Democratic presidential nominee has won the White House without winning this state since 1948. It is a must-win for Kamala Harris. And to win this state,
she has to win this city, Philadelphia, by a huge blowout margin. Can she do it? We've come outside the centre of the city now to a suburb, a trendy suburb. It's Fishtown. It's a very democratic area in its politics. A lot of young families living here, and among them, Julia Taruso, who is the political reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
For a long, long time, the way you won as a Democrat in Pennsylvania was to drive turnout up in Philadelphia, get all your voters out there and in Pittsburgh and some of the suburbs, and a Democrat could win Pennsylvania.
And in Philadelphia, how has she done? How is she doing?
I was with her just this past weekend. She went to church in a very black part of West Philadelphia. She went to a barber shop. She went to a Puerto Rican restaurant. She's really tried to focus on the parts of the city that often have lower turnout.
What is it that hasn't cut through to those communities she ought to be cutting through to? Is it possible to say what it is?
Well, in Philadelphia specifically, we are still, unfortunately, the poorest big city in America. So nationally, the big issue in this campaign is the economy, and in Philadelphia and in Pennsylvania, that's the case for voters, too.
And Donald Trump is aware of that. Has he been working? I mean, you've made it plain, this city is a Democratic city, but has the Trump campaign in Philadelphia been trying to just pull away enough voters who would in the past have voted Democratic to make the crucial difference?
The Trump campaign has had the biggest footprint in Philadelphia that a Republican campaign has had in years and years and years. Now, that's not to say he's here all the time. He did one big rally here over the summer, but just kind of their ground game. It's not as big as the Democrats by any means, but they are here. They are doing things. And, you know, I think the hope for them is that even if some of those voters don't come out and vote for Trump, they might stay home, and that helps Trump here.
We've hopped in a car now to cross Philadelphia to go to one of the few areas of the city that you can honestly say is a Republican stronghold. And the reason we're going there is to hear from Republicans themselves about the degree of confidence they have that Trump really is doing some business in this city that'll make a difference.
My name is Joseph Accavino.
And you're going to be a Trump voter?
Yes, sir.
You've got a Trump cap on?
Yep, Trump Vance.
Why?
The economy, the way people are feeling, the way everything is. Most people, you know, can't afford to live right now. Can't afford rent, can't afford gas, can't afford the food you eat, the clothes you put on your back, you know. 2016, the economy was well under Trump. Biden came in, Harris came in, crushed it, highest inflation rate, destroyed everything. And then now, you know, Trump's going to have to come back in and fix what Harris and Biden failed to do.
Josh Novotny. I'm a partner at SBL Strategies, which is a lobbying firm based out of D.C., but I live in Philadelphia, and I'm a local ward leader and involved with politics and worked for many Pennsylvania politicians. So locally, Philadelphia is broken up by wards. So this is what's called the 26th ward. The neighborhood's called Packer Park. Politically, it leans Republican for sure. It's one of the few wards in Philadelphia that actually has a Republican majority for most elections.
And how's it doing as a campaign place for you this time around?
Yeah, it's actually a hotbed for Trump. It is extremely lively for Trump, enthusiastic, and we have tons of early data showing it's going to be heavy turnouts.
So this city, we keep coming back to this city. Yeah. She's going to win this city.
She'll win
but,
the city.
But your point is, by how much?
Correct. So, you know, an old campaign hat like myself who's been in a few statewide Pennsylvania war rooms on election night, the first county to come in, for the most part, is Philadelphia. And it's a gut punch for Republicans. You're down 400,000 or 500,000 votes to start off the evening, and it's a long claw back. Now, if you can shave that down by 20, 30, 40,000 votes, that makes the rest of the night a lot easier.
20, 30, 40, I mean, it's not many votes, is it?
No. He won the state by 30 or 40,000. No, I think it was less than that in 2016, and he lost by a little bit over 80,000 in 2020.
And this huge nation with whatever it is now, 340 million people in it, actually really coming down to tens of thousands of people in this one city.
Yeah, in probably the ward we're in right now.
Fascinating in Philadelphia. Justin, as I listen to that, I just find myself wondering whether any of this is really about the issues. When you talk to Philadelphia voters, is it not just a question of which tribe they're in, which side you cheer for, which side you boo?
Yeah, which we've been saying all summer and which is unquestionably true. It's about culture, really, as much as anything else. And as much as you are supporting your own culture, you are
registering dislike of the opposing culture, and that is very much what it has come down to. But it's also about enthusiasm, which I think you pick up in the nervousness, actually, on both sides in this city, in Philadelphia, but more widely in the swing states. And that nervousness is about whether or not they can get their own people, in a sense, whether their people hate the opposing culture enough to get them to the polls. Now, 50 million, I think more than 50 million now, Americans have already voted, it's worth saying. But of course, still next Tuesday matters. And the ability to get people to the polls next Tuesday in these swing states, and particularly here in Pennsylvania, is going to make all the difference.
And is that why these arguments about language, what his supporters say about Puerto Rico, what he says about women, is not about converting people, but persuading people to get off the couch and get out to the polls?
100%, 100%. So when his supporters are told by him that Joe Biden has called you garbage, something Joe Biden has said was misinterpreted, but it seemed plain enough to anyone who heard it, that just is one of those tipping things that persuades them. We are so angry about it. We are so annoyed about it. We will get up. You know, people talk about here the choice between the candidate and the couch. And that is the thing that gets you up off the couch. And similarly for Kamala Harris out there campaigning with Jennifer Lopez. If enough women feel that Donald Trump treats them with disrespect, hears sentences from him that horrify them, then they too perhaps will avoid the couch next Tuesday.
Now, you're going to be presenting the program over the next few days running up to the vote from the United States and, of course, beyond that. Where are you going next? What should we look out for, look forward to?
Yeah, we're going to North Carolina because this isn't the only swing state. Of course, there are six or seven of them. North Carolina, potentially an important one. Also recently had the damage from the hurricane. So all sorts of sort of things up in the air in North Carolina. And then we'll end up in D.C. and we'll be in D.C. Yeah, as you say, we'll be in D.C. for the night. And who knows, we could get a result on the night. There are some people who suggest, we were hearing earlier in the program, one longtime commentator saying, actually, she thought that there would be a result on the night, but it's equally possible that because of the difficulties of voting, of counting the vote in this state, actually, quite apart from all the others in Pennsylvania, that actually it will be too close to call and it will go on for days. And that, of course, is where the dangers come for the process and for the nation.
Now, you might worry that Justin's having no fun while he's over there with Mariana for Americast as well. Just go on to his Twitter account. You'll see them in Halloween glitter.
Justin.
You managed to have fun. We'll talk later. It's now 24 minutes past eight. When politicians want to judge a budget, they often look to the opinion polls. Economists look to the markets, in particular, the value of the pound and the cost of servicing government debt. The interest rate, in other words, that the markets demand to buy that debt. And both things have not looked that good for the government since Rachel Reeves sat down. The pound has gone down and the cost of paying for that debt has gone up. We'll talk to the Chief Secretary to the Treasury, the Chancellor's Deputy, in just a moment. First, though, our economics editor, Faisal Islam. We hear these words about yields and gilts and I become baffled, Faisal. So when we talk about watching the markets, what are we actually watching for?
Well, I've got the screens in front of me, Nick, and what we look for is the effective interest rates the markets would charge the government over for a two-year loan, a five-year loan, a 10-year loan, and what's happening in the currency markets. And directionally, as you say, the effective interest rate has gone up by, you know, around just under a quarter of a percentage point, and the pound has gone down by less than a percentage point. So directionally, you know, okay, is there a message there? I think since the mini budget 2 years ago, people are sensitive about this stuff. And I think it's important to put some context in there. The moves are about a tenth of what we saw around the mini budget. And so, for example, just take the currency move, 0.8% down against the dollar. By this stage after the mini budget, we were 8% down against the dollar, not to a 2 month low, but to an all time low against the dollar since it had been invented in 1792. So that doesn't mean there's nothing to see here. There is a sort of market reaction that you can see, and it's a sort of repricing orderly. Was this borrowing more than we expected? It's probably more the fact that because there may be an inflationary impact from the extra demand over the past couple of years, the question the market's asking is, will the Bank of England react with slower than initially anticipated interest rate cuts? Again, 0.25% less than you might have expected. So that's what we're sort of seeing.
So this is not, you're being clear, a post-Liz Truss mini-budget style panic. It is, though, potentially a problem longer term, not just for government, for taxpayers, if we all pay more for debt, and there's a lot more debt because the government's borrowing a lot more.
Yeah, and that's a natural market reaction. Let's be clear, there are different players in a market. That's what makes a market. We've heard two different views on the show in the past couple of hours in our markets segment, and so have I. You know, I've had people saying nothing to see here. I've had people saying, watch out, the hedge funds are active in terms of the 2 year. That means that they're sort of piling in to sell. I've heard others saying that more nuanced point. Well, we're waiting now to hear what the Bank of England say. They've got a decision and a new forecast next week amid other market volatility around the US election. And I think that certainly if, you know, government ministers want to make sure they don't put their foot in it over the next few days, when the market is sensitive, I'll put it like that.
Sensitive. Interesting. And someone who's going to be sensitive to the markets being sensitive and the headlines around it is the Chief Secretary of the Treasury, Darren Jones, who was listening to that. Good morning to you, Mr. Jones.
Good morning.
It's not exactly a vote of confidence if the pound's going down and the cost of our debt's going up, is it?
Well, the vote of confidence from the Office of Budget Responsibility and others was into our strong fiscal rules. Our stability rule means that day-to-day spending on public services will be paid for by tax receipts instead of borrowing each and every month to pay the bills, as the Conservatives did.
Sure, but I'm more interested in the votes of people with enormous amounts of cash in global markets, aren't I, than some economists who work in a quango.
But these rules are important because it's about borrowing. So we will not be borrowing for day-to-day costs. We're going to meet that fiscal rule earlier than planned in 2027-28. That's the first time the UK's budget for public services will be in surplus since Labour was last in government. And where we are investing in the country, our investment rule means that debt as a size of the economy is falling over the forecast period. And actually, if you look at the OBR numbers, we're in a period of fiscal consolidation. We've inherited an economy that's over 4% in terms of debt as a share of the economy. At the end of the forecast period, our time in office cut before the next election, it comes down to about 2%. So there are very strong, robust fiscal rules in place. There are guardrails to make sure that every single pound of taxpayers' money and investment is being spent well. But we have made that decision at this budget to invest in our country, not to continue down a path of decline.
What's interesting is that you felt the need to come on the media to repeat what the Chancellor said and to repeat it again and again to try and reassure markets. I put it to you again, these are people who make bets, aren't they? They're people who decide whether to back Britain effectively and the way Britain's economy is run, or another country instead. And at the moment, at the margins, we're not saying it's like Liz Truss, they're betting against you.
Well, look, let's look at the behaviours that we inherited. I mean,
let's look at what's happening now rather than inherited. Because I'm asking about now and you're talking about something else.
No, because the contrast is important, Nick, which is why I'm making the point. As I said, our stability rule means that we will no longer have to borrow money each and every month just to pay the country's bills. Like, people at home will understand that that is the right thing to do, and we will be in the budget surplus in 27-28, the first time this country has been in that place since the last Labour government. So you're not just borrowing money all of the time to pay the day-to-day bills. Where you are investing in the country is to invest in infrastructure, in growth.
Do you think that message has not been heard? Is that why you're repeating something that we've heard on the programme several times? You think the markets are not hearing, or do you think something else is going on? We know there are speculators in the market. Do you think people are playing games with a new Labour government, maybe trying to bet against you?
I mean, I don't think so. You'd have to ask people that participate in the market. But the reason I'm making these points to you
about fiscal... It's a possibility, isn't it? We've seen it in the past. We saw it around the Brexit vote. We've seen it on previous occasions. Big hedge funders, people with large amounts of money might think, let's have a little pop at this Labour government, see where we get to.
What I can tell you is that our new robust fiscal rules, independently verified, show that we're meeting those fiscal rules ahead of target. They are robust and in place for a reason, but it does allow us to invest in public services and the economy, because our diagnosis, our political diagnosis, has been the reason the country has not been growing and tipping into recession in the past. The reason our public services are not performing well and therefore costing more is because of the cuts to investment over the last 14 years. So yes, we have decided to choose investment over decline, but we have done so in a responsible way with robust fiscal rules, meeting those targets ahead of schedule. That is the right and confident thing to do.
I'm hearing you. Those who are very familiar with your arguments and studied the budget in huge detail and understand the numbers at the Institute for Fiscal Study, the experts there said, for all they say, they're coming back for more. The numbers simply aren't sustainable. Even with £140 billion more borrowing in the next few years, they calculate you will have to raise another £9 billion to avoid real terms cuts in public spending in the departments you want to protect. And that means you will have to come back for more tax or more borrowing.
That assumes public services are performing at their current levels of productivity. Now, you know, if you look at the Institute for Government, do a report every year about the state of the state, the state of our public services. We are very clear that our public services that we've inherited from the last government are in a poor place. They are not performing as well as they should do. That's why public sector reform is as important as growth in the economy, because you have to get public services be performing more productively to get a grip of spending.
Things that people regard as public services, they've been on the programme today, GPs, for example, care homes. And they say you're taking money away from them. National insurance is going up for employers, amongst them GPs and care homes.
Well, let's take the NHS and social care system as the example. For the first time, the NHS budget has tipped over £200 billion a year. That's not even including the money that goes through councils into social care. But everybody recognises that the system is broken. The Health Secretary will have been on your show repeatedly saying that, talking about the energy this government has to reform the NHS. And this is a classic example, whether it's in health or SEND or looked after children or the use of asylum hotels or the way we deliver major projects and infrastructure, we've inherited a set of public services that are in desperate need of investment and modernisation. That is what this government is going to do. And the IFS figures assume that there are no productivity improvements in public services. And I do not recognise that that is the future that this government is going to deliver.
Darren Jones, Chief Secretary of the Treasury, thank you for joining us on today.
27 minutes to nine to the sport. Here's Mike.
Justin, thank you. A heavy defeat for England's cricketers in the Caribbean overnight. They lost the first one-day international with the West Indies by 8 wickets. The second ODI is tomorrow in Antigua. Meanwhile, British number one Jack Draper is out of the Paris Masters Tennis. He was beaten in the third round by Australia's Alex de Minaur. Now, one of the best weekends of the football season is upon us. For supporters of teams outside the top two divisions in England, that is. I, of course, talk of FA Cup first round weekend. Plenty of intriguing ties to look out for. 32 non-league sides still left in the competition at this stage. The lowest ranked team left in the tournament is Hensford Town. They play in the 8th tier and take on fellow non-leaguers Gainsborough Trinity tomorrow. The first round begins this evening, though, with another non-league side looking to cause an upset.
Number 50.
Number 50 are Tamworth, 14th in the National League.
26.
Facing Huddersfield Town in League One. They have won it.
Yes, can Tamworth of the National League be the giant killers later? They take on former winners Huddersfield. Huddersfield winning the FA Cup, not recently, granted, 102 years ago in 1922, but former winners nonetheless. Tamworth are their opponents this evening in a match you can watch live on BBC Two. And I'm delighted to say that we can speak to the Tamworth manager, Andy Peakes, who joins us on the programme. Morning, Andy.
Good morning.
What is the mood in Tamworth this morning then, ahead of the big one against Huddersfield later? Ah, I think that might be all we're hearing from Andy. We've lost him, which is very unfortunate. Perhaps the excitement too much for Andy this morning, as we say, taking on Huddersfield in the FA Cup first round live on BBC Two later this evening. I think we could try one more time. Andy, you're there. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Sorry, it cut off last time.
No worries. So a 5,000 capacity at the Lamb Ground later this evening. What's the mood in Tamworth today?
Yeah, I think Tamworth's buzzing. It has been since the draw came out, so that's really good. So the club's literally grown the last few years. We've had a lot of success in league, so the fan base has got bigger, but obviously this draw has captivated the imagination, full stop.
Yeah, how do you approach a match like this against a superior opponent like Huddersfield? Do you see it as a free hit, or are you actually actively plotting the downfall of a team 57 places above you?
Well, we always plot against everyone because we're part-time, which obviously we're in the National League, so that's very unusual. Everyone else is full-time, so every game's a battle for us because they've got a week to do analysis where we have, you know, our workers in the college all week, so it's... This has been no different. We've got loads of info on Huddersfield, but you know, it's one thing to read the info; it's another to be able to carry out a plan to impact on it. But you know, we're going to give it a best shot. We're certainly going to enjoy it. But like I said, we want to come out of it with some credit as well.
Yeah, you mentioned that you are a support worker in a local college. How do you balance your day job with being the manager of the local football team?
Well, like you said, it's one of those really. I say it's not local because I live in Kettering, and the games that I'm at Tamworth, so it's an hour and a quarter away. So I literally work all day and then travel up in the evenings, Tuesday, Thursday. So it's a nice balance. I enjoy doing both. I like my job at the college. I think it's a good mindset away from the football, but it's becoming more and more difficult since we've got promoted and promoted. The job's bigger and bigger at Tamworth. But yeah, it's a nice balance.
Well, we wish you all the best for the big tie against Huddersfield later. Many thanks for joining us on what I'm sure will be a very busy day for you. That is Andy Peakes, manager of Tamworth, and you can watch Tamworth against Huddersfield live on BBC Two later this evening. I have very fond memories of going to Tamworth Castle as a young boy with my mum. Great part of the world, and we shall see how they get on later.
Thanks very much indeed, mate. Now, a chance to give thanks.
I'm Claudia Hammond, and I'd love to know, is there a person or a group who has made a real difference to your mental health? You can nominate them now for the All in the Mind Awards. For Josephine, winning in 2023 made her feel stronger.
The awards have given me a kind of extra superpower. It's a special recognition of a difficult task.
To enter and for full terms, visit bbc.co.uk/radio4/allinthemind. You have until 1 p.m. on Wednesday, the 8th of January, 2025 to enter. Can't wait to read what you have to say.
To the weather, cloudy with a few spots of light rain or drizzle across northern England and Scotland, mostly dry in the south, some light rain possible in the southeast, hill fog in the north.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin in Philadelphia, me, Nick Robinson, in London, alongside James Hill, who's got a summary of the news at 22 minutes to nine.
Emergency teams in Spain are struggling to restore basic services after catastrophic flooding in the eastern Valencia region. Rescue teams are scouring the area for the dozens of people that are missing. At least 158 people are known to have died, though it's feared that number will rise. GPs, care homes and hospices have voiced concerns that they will have to pay the higher employer national insurance contributions announced in the budget. They're not covered by the public sector exemption, even though they provide NHS services. The Chief Secretary to the Treasury, Darren Jones, told us the government was investing more money in the NHS and social care. BBC News has found that the Metropolitan Police was told about allegations of sexual abuse by the former Harrods owner, Mohammed Al-Fayed, a decade earlier than Scotland Yard has recently acknowledged. Al-Fayed died last year and was never charged with any sexual offences. Researchers say cutting sugar in a child's first 1,000 days from conception to age 2 appears to reduce their risk of major diseases later in life.
Jane, thank you very much indeed. It's 21 minutes to nine. Graham Norton's Saturday night talk show prides itself that it never makes the news. It's a safe, warm, enjoyable place for celebrities to promote a new book, new project, a new film, perhaps. But a conversation on Graham's sofa has gone viral. It has got the nation talking. It was a moment when actors Paul Mescal, Eddie Redmayne and Denzel Washington discussed rehearsing for a scene in which Paul had to protect himself. It was a conversation they had while Saoirse Ronan watched on before chipping in with a comment that struck a chord with millions of women watching.
Some of the techniques, though, that you learned, like some of the things Paul taught us, is how you can use your phone if someone's attacking you, the butt of your phone to go over the neck.
Who's actually going to think about that, though? If someone attacks me, I'm not going to go, phone.
I agree.
One second. That's a very good point.
Yeah, but I like
that's
the
what girls have to think about all the time.
Yeah.
Am I right, ladies?
That's what girls have to think about all of the time. Well, do they? Online, women applauded. They talked about their experiences. They shared their anxiety. So too in the Today programme office, who discussed not just what they thought, what they did when they went out, particularly after dark, but how much men, how much the men they loved and loved them, really knew, really understood what they lived through. And they came up with a bright idea. The editor texted me, admitted it was a bit of a weird idea. Why didn't I talk to my daughter about what she experienced and what she knew and what she thought about what I knew? So that's what I did yesterday. Alice is a teacher. She's in her late 20s. And we got together and watched that clip
And I asked her what she thought.
What a lot of women felt, or evidently lots of women felt, which is that it just vocalised the problem that lots of us have been saying for a long time. And it was nice to see an example of, I can use the word like male ignorance, but I don't mean that derogatory. Like, you just don't know about something if you don't have to experience it all the time. It was nice to see that reflected and someone immediately clap back and be praised for it in like a very, very short bite-sized clip.
I was struck by, there was a pause, wasn't there? As the guys didn't get it, and the women in the audience clearly did get it. So what were they getting that the guys weren't getting?
I was thinking already, I always have my phone in my hands as like a weapon. Like, I've thought about my phone as a weapon loads of times. So I imagine the pause is the men feeling awkward that they hadn't thought about that, and the women like letting it sink in, and also being excited that someone vocalised it and had the guts to say that to people who are their friends, evidently, and didn't mean any harm.
And quite a lot of people watching that clip reacted by thinking the guys didn't really want her to say what she was going to say. They seemed to be talking over her a bit, even as she had something pretty important to say.
I didn't read it like that. I read it like they just didn't... They were so seeing this as a funny joke that it didn't occur to them that something serious could be made out of it. And I think the pause was probably them reflecting on that. I don't think it seemed malicious in any way. To me, it read like, when I've talked with other men about this, where they feel a little bit uncomfortable, and it felt like they appreciated the fact that she brought it up, but they just were awkward about it.
Have you had that conversation with men?
We've had that conversation before, like 5 years ago, especially post Sarah Everard. I think there was a lot of conversations about it then.
I remember an item we did on Today, after the murder of Sarah Everard, in which young women of about your age talked about carrying keys. And I remember asking you, good God, do you have to do that? Do you remember that conversation?
Yeah, I do. We were walking together. I think it was just after lockdown had ended. So it was also that thing of like, you're on the streets again for the first time in a while, and you're having to reconsider all of those rules that you put in place for yourself. And we had a conversation about it, and you were very shocked. And something else that came up is like, people staring at you in the street. Men stare at women in a way that makes you very uncomfortable, but they don't do it in front of other men. So it becomes like this mass thing where men who don't do that don't realise that that's a thing.
My memory of that conversation is I was, yes, surprised, but also shocked at the thought that you had to put into keeping yourself safe. Something I think you talk about with women friends all the time.
Yeah, and I think women of all generations are constantly thinking about how to keep themselves safe. It's not like, it's just my generation. Like, my mum speaks about it with her friends a lot. I was talking to my partner's mum today. She was also thinking about how to keep herself safe. Everyone has different strategies. And I would say the most exhausting thing is trying to work out which strategy is the most appropriate, because a lot of them go against each other.
In what way?
So, for example, this Monday, I was on a bus in the front seats of a double-decker bus at the top, and a man stood behind me on the stairs, even though there were loads of seats free. So that's weird already. And I'm already thinking that's really weird. And people had to squeeze past him to get on and off. And then he came and sat next to me. And I know it doesn't sound like a big thing, but he'd already shown himself to be like unusual. I felt incredibly uncomfortable. There are two different strategies that probably lots of women are thinking about. A, I can leave that seat as soon as possible and get off, because my stop was next. But if I do that, then he knows that I'm getting off at the next stop. So then, is that safe? Because he could follow me off the bus. Or the other strategy is to stay in my seat as long as possible and leave myself physically vulnerable there, and then run off at my stop so he can't follow me off. But then I'm leaving myself vulnerable on the bus. So how do you juggle that? Like, which one's the correct one to do?
How did you juggle it?
I closed down Google Maps on my phone so he couldn't see where I was going, and I did get off because I didn't feel safe sitting next to him. And when I looked at the bus, when the bus left, he'd moved into a different seat. So he was definitely following me.
So that was this week.
Yeah.
How often? Is that every month? A couple of times a year? Less than that?
Do you mean like, how often do I feel unsafe, or how often is there something that is unsafe?
How often do you feel it?
Every time I go out in the dark. At any time.
At any time you're in the dark, you're feeling unsafe. Obviously, you don't know if you're unsafe, but... And doing what? The conversation on that Graham Norton show was all about using a mobile phone as a form of self-defence. Is that something you prepare to do?
I think putting your keys between your fingers is probably more common, because then you could scrape someone's face. Again, do you want to do that because then your keys are available for someone to potentially take off you or work out where you live? So there's contradictions there. Other things are keeping your, like, pretending or being on the phone with someone and saying, I will be there in 10 minutes. I'm looking forward. And sometimes you drop male names so they know that men are about to meet you who could, I guess, theoretically beat them up. I don't know.
Hold on. This is a pretend conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. Or it's a real conversation, but the events you're talking about are pretend. So either of those. My friend has my location on her phone so she can check where I am. Sometimes you wouldn't wear headphones in the dark because that could be unsafe because you don't know what's going on. But sometimes I deliberately wear headphones so people won't talk to me because you get catcalled more if you are not wearing headphones. So you have to work out which is the most safe one to do in each situation and depending on where you are.
Even though I'm hearing this for the second time, I'm shocked at how often it is. I mean, men do think about their safety. There are moments in the dark. There are dark streets, alleyways, where I'm wary, where I cross the road, where I think, I don't really want to stand next to that person. So I make calculations, but nothing like as often as you obviously do. I'm appalled that you have to think about that so often.
I think it's just something that you learn, like you're constantly looking over your shoulder to check. And there's a sense that you have to make the right decision because if something goes wrong, people will ask you what you did. And there is, like, often a culture of, like, well, she was on her own late at night. So what do you expect to happen? And you don't want to be that person.
Well, I think one thing this older man, has taken from that conversation is there's a lot of listening and there's a lot of learning to do. So thank you, Alice.
Thank you, Dad.
And that brings us to 12 minutes to nine. And you are welcome back to Philadelphia and to the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, which, excuse me, we've been saying all this morning is likely to be won by the winner of the whole race. It has 19 electoral college votes, so it's the weightiest of the swing states. It's tied in the polls. Actually, a dead heat is what they predict. Helen Lewis is the British author and journalist working for The Atlantic magazine here in the United States. She has been travelling round the state.
I think the thing that struck me most was the fact that there are many different elections going on. So for some people that you talk to, this is an election where, you know, democracy is on the ballot. You will hear Harris supporters and actually moderate Republicans or independents who just don't want to vote for Donald Trump because they think he's dangerous. You'll hear people on the other side who are voting for Trump who think that's all overblown nonsense and they're voting for the Republican because they want lower taxes and they think the economy was better under him 4 years ago. Then you'll hear from people for whom abortion and reproductive rights, one way or the other. So I talked to somebody who said, you know, I'm voting Harris after having been a double Trump voter because of the overturn of Roe versus Wade, which was a constitutional right to an abortion. I also talked to someone else completely, you know, on the completely opposite side, a young woman in a rural area who said, my one single issue is I believe in the right to life and I'm voting for Donald Trump for that reason. So trying to sum up kind of what's happening is very difficult because people are having their own individual elections.
It also affects the way the two sides have campaigned, presumably, as well.
It reminds me a little bit of the Brexit referendum, right, on which it was felt that every day that we were talking about immigration was a good day for the Leave campaign, and every day we were talking about the economy was a good day for the Remain campaign. So you're having this odd battle where actually both sides are talking past each other and trying not to get bogged down in the other side's issues.
The other thing that's really striking in these swing states is the way the kind of personas of the two candidates are played so differently, and Trump being Trump and Kamala Harris being Kamala Harris, and in a sense, I don't know, more normal, is it fair to say, as a campaigner in a way that doesn't necessarily work, I suppose, in the modern era?
I think that's very hard to reconcile yourself to. So I went to a Harris rally in Erie, Pennsylvania. And, you know, her speech was completely fine. It wasn't memorable. You know, it wasn't the Gettysburg Address. It wasn't a soaring heights of oratory. It was a nice speech. It had a couple of fairly clanking cliches in it. But I had all the time the sense that I was going to essentially a normal political event of the kind that I've covered you know, over a decade in Britain, you know, like a Labour Party conference, whatever it might be. And then you go to a Trump rally and it is halfway between a kind of mega church and WrestleMania. Everybody's dressed up, you know, people are chanting things as a kind of call and response. It's very heavy on jokes. And I think that's one of the things that's very difficult for people to put together in their heads is the way that people do have very serious concerns about Trump's authoritarianism, but they're enjoying themselves so much and they just think those two things can't possibly go together.
You've been out and about in Pennsylvania, but Georgia as well. So two of the absolute swingiest swing states. Have you got a sense of which campaign team you'd rather be on as the last few days are on us?
I think it's very hard. The polls are definitely doing something very strange and they're very hard to read. The last two times that Trump has run, they've underestimated him. So you might say, well, obviously there's a problem picking up his support. Or you might say perhaps the pollsters have overcorrected this time. So no one really has any information. That said, I do slightly wonder. I talk to lots of women who are quite quiet. You know, they wouldn't be all over X or wherever it might be shouting about this. But they are genuinely worried about the repeal of Roe versus Wade and that end of protection for abortions. And I wonder if they might be, you know, I don't think there are shy Trumpers, right? You meet people and they're very proud to be Trump supporters. They love him. They think he's great. So I'm not sure that is a caucus that is actually underrepresented. I think there might be more shy, white, non-college educated women voters than we think. So I think if I had to pick one of the campaigns, I'd obviously pick the Harris campaign because you're running a candidate who does normal things and doesn't go off script and is kind of controllable. You know, the two people who are running the Trump campaign are essentially lion taming from day to day. But it is a genuine toss up, and I don't think anybody can, you know, everyone is so desperate for some entrail reading. But there, you know, it depends on seven swing states, each of which could go either way by about 100,000 votes, and that's the entire ball game in a country of 300 million people. It's a very weird electoral system, and it's one that is very hard to predict.
Helen Lewis of the Atlantic, thank you very much.
7 minutes to 9. Well, if the American election is unpredictable, the weather is predictable in its unpredictability. In other words, we are getting used to seeing images of extreme weather, hurricane storms, waves, and those extraordinary floods that have hit Valencia in Spain. Let's talk to the Professor of Hydrology at Reading University, Professor Hannah Cloke, about what's been going on. Good morning to you, Professor Cloke. So much rain in such a short period of time. Why?
Yeah, this is a really good question. I mean, this is a real spaghetti bowl of a disaster, really, trying to unpick exactly what's happened here. Yes, there was a lot of rain that fell, but it was well forecasted. We know that climate change is making these types of storms worse. So perhaps there are the fingerprints of climate change on this storm, but we really can't use that as an excuse for not preparing for floods like this. These types of storms do happen, and the Weather Forecasting Service in Spain did pick it up.
There's some suggestion that drought then storm is constantly causing problems around the world. In other words, the ground is such that the water runs off it fast. Do you think that may be an explanation here?
Certainly, in this case, that did contribute, yes. But also we have to think about the urban planning. So we had lots of people in the way of the flood. We had a lot of paved surfaces as well that contributed to that as well. So there's a lot of stuff going on here. Some of the problem really is that people were in the way and they didn't receive the warnings that they needed. Lots of people saying, you know, they were surprised. They were already kind of neck deep in water when they got an alert on their phone. So something clearly has gone very, very wrong there.
People thinking they could drive from the flood and then finding that their car not only fills with water, but as I was describing earlier, the brake is on and your car's moving at speed through this water.
Yeah, that's one of the most dangerous things you can do in a flood. So there's obviously a lot of problems with people, you know, understanding the risk that they're in and what they should do if they do encounter a flood. Don't drive your car, definitely, or go down to the garage to try and rescue it.
Go to higher ground or go to the top of your house if you're lucky enough to have a second floor. Yeah, Professor Hannah Cloke of Reading University, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
And that brings us to 5 to 9. And a word about something coming up. Another chance to hear Steven Spielberg on Desert Island Discs this morning. It's after 9 o'clock, after the news summary. And if you've ever wondered what the stars of stage and screen eat to fuel their performances. We have an exploration of backstage food later this morning on Radio 4, the food programme at 11 o'clock.
Now, Justin, we are going to let you get some sleep in a second. It is what time currently in Philadelphia?
It is, well, it's 5 to 5. It's morning time.
You've been up all day and all night to do the Today programme. Just some more first impressions, if we could. I was struck in your report by the couple who said, we don't want to talk about this. we don't talk about politics. As you've gone round, are there plenty of people who are like, no, don't want to talk about the election. It just makes us miserable, reminds us of our divisions.
Yeah, there really are. And so you mentioned earlier on, we went trick or treating last night for Americast. And it's really interesting. You get a kind of completely different vision of America. You get the old fashioned sort of homespun vision, albeit we were in a kind of upmarket suburb of Philadelphia. People were living in nice houses with porches and their kids able to, you know, afford all the rigmarole that goes with Halloween. But you got this sense of actually people wanting to be out talking to each other. And the street where we were had signs for Harris and Walls, and also had signs for Trump. And it didn't seem to matter, actually. And people were mingling. And we talked actually to some people there about how they were getting on with their neighbours. And I think some of them feel that we, that the media generally, that the political class just overestimate sometimes the degree of division that there is. But at the same time, you heard in that piece we ran earlier on, a guy and his mum, semi-jokingly, but only semi, I got the impression actually, really properly fallen out over Trump. And that has also been the experience of families the length and breadth of the place. So, you know, these divisions run hard. And I think the fear among a lot of people is that they don't end next Tuesday or whenever the result comes, which may be a little bit after
Tuesday.
May
well not be Tuesday.
It goes on. And that kind of those divisions go on. That's the fear that they have.
Talking of joking, I was struck by your conversation with Helen Lewis just a few minutes ago about the role of humour. Let's be honest, there are many people in this country who simply don't understand how anybody can vote for Trump. There are plenty who do, but there are many who say to me, how can anyone? He makes them feel better, many Americans, about themselves and their country, doesn't he? That use of humour makes them feel better in difficult times.
It's really striking. I think the most striking thing I've felt since arriving in Pennsylvania, when you look at the TV, when you talk to people about Trump, they don't see him as a politician, even though he's been president, and they don't also see, really crucially, they don't see him as the kind of person who is serious all the time. So when he's accused of being a fascist, etc., it just doesn't, with a large segment of the electorate, ring true. It doesn't feel like the man that they see on the screens, the man getting in and out of garbage trucks recently, the man extemporizing on podcasts, etc., etc. There is a clash of images between the ones that the Democrats have tried to pin on him and the way a lot of people just see him.
Now, we've got to let you, get some sleep, and then, B, off to North Carolina.
Yeah, that's right. North Carolina next, and then obviously we'll be in D.C. for the result itself, if it comes next Tuesday. But, I mean, there'll certainly be an awful lot happening during the course of the night into Wednesday, and then onwards from there, possibly to the courts.